razor and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, God, I voted.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting February 16th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
In 1950, this day saw the swearing-in of Fidel Castro as Cuba's first post-revolutionary prime minister. Castro, a Cuban native from an affluent family, had opposed the regime of the U.S.-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista, who seized power in a coup in 1951. Castro made several unsuccessful attempts to launch the revolution, and at one point his forces had dwindled to just 9 men, including Argentine Marxist Ernesto Che Guevara. They hid in the Sierra Maestra Mountains, Castro's old childhood stomping ground, and fomented rebellion among the peasant class, based largely on the promise of land reform. Soon after taking charge, Castro nationalized a number of Cuba's assets, which had been held by U.S. companies. This and the long-promised land reform measures Castro implemented moved many of the island's wealthier families to emigrate to the U.S. And in 1961, the CIA, under the Kennedy administration, financed a mercenary army of Cuban exiles to invade the island and resume the previous dictatorship. The effort failed and became a national embarrassment for the Kennedy administration. It also led to the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, wherein the Soviet Union installed a number of missile bases in Cuba as a deterrent to future invasion attempts by the U.S. And according to a number of sources, today marked the first documented instance of U.S. military advisors taking part directly in combat operations in El Salvador. In reality, the U.S. military advisors had been directing the Salvadoran government's counterinsurgency war against the FMLN, El Salvador's democratic leftist guerrilla organization. During the Iran-Contra hearings in 1987, the combat role of U.S. military personnel in El Salvador was discussed, and several years before that, a number of advisors were killed while flying reconnaissance missions to pinpoint rebel encampments for airstrikes. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, February 16th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
This Week in Radical History for February 17th, 1933, reports of 2 weeks of violence against labor unions and leaders make its way back to the United States, and coverage of Nazi concentration camps appear in magazines such as the AIZ in 1933. This publicly available information did nothing to dampen the enthusiasm of Hitler's financial supporters or the press agents in Europe and the United States, such as Henry Ford. Meanwhile, real journalists like George Selds, who documented the ties between American companies and Nazis, were suppressed. His stories were censored by U.S. press, and his 170,000 subscriber newsletters was driven out of business by J. Edgar Hoover's America's Secret Police, the FBI. Also on February 17, 1940 in Canada, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman suffers a severe stroke which leaves her paralyzed on the right side and unable to speak. She's rushed to the hospital where she remains for 6 weeks. After growing up in the United States, Emma would be deported by the government during the Red Scare years. Emma was banned from the country, called the Land of the Free, since 1931. Emma would die on May 14, 1940 in Toronto, Canada, her death following her visa back in the United States, where she was buried in Waldheim Cemetery next to the Haymarket Martyrs in Chicago suburb. Anti-anarchist law continued to be used to prevent certain people from entering the United States, as question number 25 on the intake form at Ellis Island asks, "Are you an anarchist?" which would automatically disqualify you from entering the United States.
On this day, February 17th, in 1975, 2 years before the famous anti-nuclear protest and occupation of the Seabrook nuclear power plant construction site in New Hampshire, more than 20,000 protesters in Germany occupied the proposed site of another nuclear power plant in Weil, Germany, near the Rhine River. Unlike the Seabrook protest, the German occupiers, who were far greater in number, resisted police attempts to arrest them and maintained effective control of the location for a number of months. The German authorities abandoned the construction plans as a result, whereas at Seabrook, the nuclear power plant there was eventually built. Some 20 years later, the Weil site was made into a nature preserve, thus protecting sensitive wetlands that would have been destroyed had the nuclear facility been built. And on this day in 1982, another massacre of civilians in the El Quiche region of Guatemala was carried out by the armed forces under the command of U.S.-backed Guatemalan dictator José Efraín Ríos Montt. Over a period of several years, more than 600 massacres were carried out against the mostly Mayan population of El Quiche by the Rios Montt regime as part of a strategy to break the will of the Guatemalan resistance movement. Rios Montt was a graduate of the infamous School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, where Latin American military personnel are trained in so-called counterinsurgency techniques, including torture, sabotage, and, as Rios Montt demonstrated, the mass murder of innocent civilians. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, February 17th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
This week in radical history, for February 18th, 1851, United States, a crowd of Boston blacks break into federal prison, rescue Frederick Jenkins, a southern slave jailed under the terms of the Fugitive Slave Act, and spirit him away to freedom in Canada. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 made any federal marshal or any other official who did not arrest an alleged runaway slave liable for a fine up to $1,000. Law enforcement officials anywhere now had the duty to arrest anyone suspected of being a runaway slave on no more evidence than the complainant's sworn testimony of ownership. The suspected slave could not even ask for a jury trial to testify in his or her own behalf. In addition, any person aiding a runaway slave or by providing food or shelter was subject to 6 months imprisonment and also $1,000 fine. Officers who captured a fugitive slave were entitled to a bonus for their work as well. Slave owners only needed to supply an affidavit to the federal marshal to capture an escaped slave. Since any suspect slave was not eligible for trial, this led to many free blacks being conscripted into slavery as they had no rights in courts and could not defend themselves against any accusations. Lastly, for February 18, 1861, Apaho and Cheyenne are forced to cede most of eastern Colorado, land guaranteed them, quote, forever, unquote, in a treaty signed 10 years earlier. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 19th in 1942, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. These four little numbers sentenced some 120,000 people of Japanese descent to a harsh life in American concentration camps. Apparently, because of Pearl Harbor, all persons of Japanese descent were potential spies. More than two-thirds of those who were captured were American citizens, and at least half of them were children. By the end of World War II, only 10 people were actually convicted of spying for Japan, all of whom were white. Talk about racial profiling. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in radical history, for February 20th, 1895, Frederick Douglass, escaped slave, anti-slavery leader, and advisor to Lincoln, dies at age 78. In 1875 address, Douglass proclaimed, quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want an ocean without its awful roar and its many waters. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will." Unquote. Also on February 20th, 1941, Buffy St. Marie, folk singer born on a reservation in Canada, she wrote this popular protest song in 1964, Universal Soldier.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill me for you, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan. And he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, and fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the walls. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon to a war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. He is the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. But his orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
Speaking about war and soldiers, on February 20th, on this date in 2005, Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson dies at age 67 by suicide. A couple months previous, he wrote, quote, "We have become the Nazi monster in the eyes of the whole world, a nation of bullies and bastards who would rather kill than live peacefully. We are not just whores of power and oil, but killer whores with hate and fear in our hearts. We are human scum, and that's how history will judge us. No redeeming social value, just whores." Unquote. Hunter S. Thompson. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 21st, in 1965, Malcolm X was assassinated. He was just about to deliver a speech in the Audubon Ballroom in Manhattan when a man came forward from the crowd, shooting him in the chest with a shotgun. Malcolm X was a powerful civil rights and human rights leader in America who associated himself with the Nation of Islam until right before his death. While some believe that the Nation of Islam was behind his assassination, Malcolm X's radical race politics definitely intimidated a number of people. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
Also on February 21st, 1972, the Harrisburg Seven. This was a group of religious anti-war activists. Six of the seven were Irish Catholic nuns and priests. They were charged with attempting to kidnap National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger and planning to blow up some steam tunnels. The trial would end in a hung jury and all would be eventually released. People, the time's
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, February 22nd, in 1879, F.W. Woolworth opened his very first five-and-dime store in Utica, New York. As the Woolworth Company spread, the stores began to incorporate lunch counters, serving food and drinks to the public. In the South, segregated Woolworth lunch counters became very significant in the civil rights movement. The Greensboro sit-in in 1960, which took place at a Woolworth lunch counter, ignited a huge movement of sit-ins and boycotts all over the South. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it.
Wasting my wealth and telling myself to go to hell. My arm in a cast, my heart like a corn cob. Do not disturb sign hanging on the doorknob. My brain is unplugged, my life in my luggage. My cruelty is dependable, my ugliness is rugged. Smoke still slow dances out of my barrel. In the distance I can hear a kid singing a Christmas carol. And this is terrible, gorgeous and sinister. The pillow still smells like the secrets of a visitor. No one needs to know about this kind of thing. Blood on my back from the attack of her diamond ring. And me of all people, my mind's in a tailspin. I'm just a door-to-door encyclopedia salesman. Part of me feels like dirt, the rest doesn't know. She said I'm a way better lover than her husband.
This has been This Week in Radical History, produced at the Mobile Fortress of Glee, Glee Studios. Special thanks again to this week's Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York and the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio, whose awesome audio I borrowed for this week's show. Inspiration for this segment came from the Slingshot organizer, and much of the radical info for the show came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. So this week is the one-year anniversary of my show. It's kind of morphed from where it began, but it's been a hell of a fun ride. Thanks for taking it with me. Next couple of weeks, I'll be traveling a lot, visiting rad peeps and locales. So this week in radical history may be an abridged version for next couple of weeks or three. Got to now hit the road. We're ending this week's show with a song from Buck 65. And always, each and every week, I am forever yours in the struggle. Mike Cannon. Going out of my mind, kind of holding my face in my hands like fine china.
Undercover, literally. I told her about Cuba. I told her about Italy. Physics and photography, a little Russian history. Everything about her to me was such a mystery. I gave her the once over. She gave me the blood blister. She had no idea I was falling in love with her. Call me Mister. Crucial inspiration. All she wanted was my lust and useful information. What am I putting myself through this crap for? Feels like I'm standing on top of a trapdoor. Lost at sea. Tangled up in golden hair, scavenger hunter. My life is like a folding chair. My daily routine is down to a system. I give the regular people truth and wisdom. That's what I do, it's my job to profit. I can see the future and make money off it. Love cares a whole lot of
talk about this, and you will be kind.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
لم تطيه قوس قزح طفلة لم تطيه قوس قزح من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with a report from the Electronic Intifada, written by Charlotte Silver. It involves yet another attempt on the part of Palestinian lawyers to challenge the Israeli theft of land that has become the hallmark of the Israeli occupation. Such lawsuits have been overwhelmingly unsuccessful in the biased Israeli courts, but continue to be brought by Palestinian lawyers as acts of resistance. Palestinians will continue to challenge home demolitions wall expansion, land theft, and, in fact, every vestige of occupation with all the tools available to them, including the courts. But there seems to be some optimism that this line of legal challenge might be successful. Charlotte Silver writes, "A lawsuit filed with Israel's High Court might open a new legal course for scores of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank who have had their land seized by the military over the last 50 years. Though Israel's High Court has a history of ruling favorably on expanding settlements, Dror Etkes, a longtime Israeli settlement researcher, promises the new lawsuit is a first of its kind that could trigger dozens more like it. When Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, its military proceeded to seize huge swaths of land under various pretexts. By 1987, the military had seized 40% of the land in the West Bank, along with its major water resources. To confiscate such vast tracts of Palestinian farmland, Israel frequently invoked temporary military or security reasons. The Hague Regulations, the set of international laws that pertain to war and occupation, allow an occupying power to take temporary possession of land for military use. And once taken, access to the land was blocked to its Palestinian owners. How that land was ultimately used varied, but it frequently passed through the military's hands and became an Israeli civilian settlement. That is what happened just outside Hebron, where Israel founded Kiryat Arba, one of its first settlements in the West Bank, on a military base in 1968, and further north in Al-Baray and Dura al-Kar, where the military seized Palestinian land for military purposes, only to use it to establish the Bet El settlement. And that is the case of Akraba, a village in the north of the occupied West Bank near Nablus. Now the village is suing the Israeli state in what some hope will be a precedent-setting lawsuit. In 1972, Israel expropriated about 90% of Akraba's farmland, or 50 square miles, said Etkes, who has researched the history of the village. The huge expropriation left dozens of families who once cultivated the Fair Valley with no source of livelihoods. Aerial photographs taken on the eve of the seizure show the area was filled with cultivated plots of land. Focusing on just one parcel of the seized land, about 790 acres, Etkes has helped organize the lawsuit against the Israeli state, settlers, and quarry companies to give the land back to the original owners. This land was originally taken under the auspices of temporary military necessity, Etkes said, but it eventually formed the cornerstone of the civilian settlement of Gittit. The petition, filed on behalf of the Akraba municipality and the families of the original owners of the land in October last year, calls on the Israeli government to cancel the seizure order made in 1972, Etkes said, because there is no longer any security or military grounds to justify the confiscation. As of now, the government has not fully replied to the petition. They are biding their time, Etkes told the Electronic Intifada. They understand this could be the beginning of other similar claims. They, the Israeli military, could find themselves under a flood of similar petitions. In the first 12 years of the occupation, Israel seized about 12,000 acres for temporary military use. Nearly a half century later, the essential and urgent military needs for the land once argued by Israel have been clearly exposed as a means to settle Jews in the occupied territories. The Geneva Conventions, which regulate the humanitarian conduct and obligations in conflict, prohibit an occupying power from transferring its civilian population to the occupied territory. According to Etkus, after 1975, settlers took over cultivating the land that once belonged to Palestinian families. At the outbreak of the Palestinian uprising in 2000, the land fell into disuse before settlers began subletting it to Palestinians. Etkus noted the irony in Palestinians paying settlers to access their historic land. Over time, Etkus said, large-scale farms run by settlers have pushed out smaller Palestinian farms, and today, Akraba's land is mostly cultivated by a few Israeli settler operations. In the process of researching how the land has been used, Etkus discovered that a portion of the 3,200 dunam parcel was given over to open an Israeli quarry in 2001. It operated for just a few months and was shut down by 2002. "You can see a scar in the mountain today," Etkus said, "but no operation." The Shafir Corporation plans to resume mining on the location, as was revealed in the course of the petition. The village's petition argues that this violates the state's promise that it would not open any new Israeli quarries in the West Bank per the High Court recommendation in 2011. At the time of the ruling, there were some 10 Israeli quarries operating in the West Bank. These deliver almost all their material over the 1949 armistice line separating the occupied West Bank from present-day Israel, violating the international laws of occupation and human rights law. The High Court ruled that those quarries may still operate, stating Israel had the right to utilize natural resources in a reasonable manner, but recommended no new sites be opened. The Shafir Company and the Civil Administration, Israel's occupying authority, say the 2011 ruling does not apply to the quarry in Akraba because it was licensed before the ruling. Furthermore, Shafir claims it intends to sell most of what is mined there to Palestinians, according to Etkus. Last year, Human Rights Watch reported that Israeli quarries sell 94% of the materials they produce to Israel or Israeli settlements and pay fees to settlement municipalities and the civil administration, which cannot be said to benefit the Palestinian people. The Hague regulations prohibit an occupying power from using the resources of the occupied territory for domestic purposes. The Akraba petition is not the first time Israel's High Court will review the military's security rationalization for settlements in the occupied territories. Over the decades, the High Court has avoided issuing rulings that have far-reaching implications for the government's settler colonial project in the West Bank, in effect, greenlighting it. In 1979, for example, the High Court argued with the military that a civilian settlement, that is Beit El, built on land requisitioned for military needs, can in fact serve a military purpose. However, shortly after, the court mitigated this ruling with a new decision on the Elon Moray settlement. In this case, the military had tried to argue the Elon Moray settlement served a military purpose after settlers had established an unauthorized colony on private Palestinian land. The High Court ruled this settlement did not clearly serve military purposes, leading the Israeli government to focus on seizing and declaring Palestinian land as state land for its settlements. The High Court has maintained that its decisions will be made on a case-by-case basis. This case will be important in terms of the legal strategy which we will be able to use in the coming years regarding similar cases, said Etkes, who expects a reply from the government before the next court session, scheduled for March. Now, that is a report written by Charlotte Silver, associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. But now a new wrinkle that could upset the optimism that this lawsuit has engendered. Just this past Monday, February 6th, the Knesset passed a bold new bill that would allow for land confiscation that heretofore was illegal to now be legal. Exactly how this new law will affect the current litigation is unclear, but it certainly adds a new dimension to the conflict. Freelance journalist Shireen Kalel, who writes out of Palestine, Jordan, and Israel, wrote the following article following the passage of the new law. The Israeli Knesset on Monday passed a controversial new bill that allows the Israeli government to expropriate private Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, making more than a dozen Israeli settlements legal under Israeli law. The unprecedented bill passed late Monday night with 60 votes in favor to 52 against, according to Palestinian government news agency WAFA. The legislation, referred to as the Regularization Bill, legalizes more than 4,000 settler outpost units under Israeli law and has been dubbed the first step toward de facto annexation. It is the first time in history that the Knesset has imposed Israeli civil law in the occupied West Bank, which is under Israeli military and civilian rule. The sponsors of the bill said the law was an historic step toward the completion of a process that we plan to lead. The application of full Israeli sovereignty on all of the cities and communities in Judea and Samaria, according to the Jerusalem Post. Following the bill's passing, Education Minister Naftali Bennett tweeted one word, revolution. The law is in direct contravention with international law, which deems all Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem illegal. Following the vote, international and local human rights groups strongly condemned the new legislation. Meanwhile, the European Union canceled a summit between Israel and the European Union scheduled for February 28th, according to the Israeli daily Haaretz. The daily reported that France, Sweden, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Finland publicly expressed their reservations regarding the summit, and that some countries argued that holding a meeting at this time would be akin to rewarding Israel for its bad conduct. B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights NGO, called the bill a slap in the face of the international community. The Knesset today proved yet again that Israel has no intention of ending its control over the Palestinians or its theft of their land.
Lending a semblance of legality to this ongoing act of plunder is a disgrace for the state and its legislature, the group said in a statement. Omar Shakir, Israel and Palestine country director at Human Rights Watch, said the legislation reflects Israel's manifest disregard of international law. The bill further entrenches the current reality in the West Bank of de facto permanent occupation, where Israeli settlers and Palestinians living in the same territory are subject to separate and unequal systems of laws, rules, and services, Shakir said. Israeli officials driving settlement policy should know that the Trump administration cannot shield them from the scrutiny of the International Criminal Court, where the prosecutor continues to examine unlawful Israeli settlement activity. On Monday, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, said passing such a law would amount to a declaration of war. After the vote, PLO Executive Committee member Dr. Hanan Ashrari expressed concern for what the law would mean for future land annexation by Israel. Such a law signals the final annexation of the West Bank. Not only does it attempt to retroactively legalize the settlements and outposts built on Palestinian private property, it also gives clear license to the settlers to embark on a land grab in the occupied West Bank with impunity, she said. Israel is authorizing the unlawful act of land theft and its illegal settlement activities, which are a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and an egregious violation of international law and conventions, she said. All settlements are illegal, whether on private property or on state land that belongs to the Palestinian collective as a whole. This also proves beyond doubt that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist racist coalition government are deliberately breaking the law and destroying the very foundations of the two-state solution and the chances for peace and stability. Xavier Abu Eid, a spokesperson for the PLO's Negotiation Affairs Department, said the law essentially legalized theft of Palestinian land, adding that the legislation negates peace and the possibility of a two-state solution. Looting is illegal, said Abu Eid. All Israeli settlements in occupied Palestine are illegal and a war crime, regardless of any law passed by the Israeli parliament or any decision taken by an Israeli judge. Peace Now, an Israeli NGO aimed at promoting a two-state solution, strongly condemned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for being willing to compromise the future of both Israelis and Palestinians in order to satisfy a small group of extreme settlers for the sake of his own political survival, and called on the Israeli Supreme Court to overturn the legislation. By passing this law, Netanyahu makes theft an official Israeli policy and stains the Israeli law books. By giving a green light to settlers to build illegally on private Palestinian land, the legalization law is another step towards annexation and away from a two-state solution. In light of this madness, we must act as the responsible adults and turn to the Supreme Court in order to strike down this dangerous law. That was an article written by freelance journalist Shireen Kalel. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is a conversation with a remarkable journalist, Remara Haas, who writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. The conversation is with Chris Hedges, a journalist who has written for the New York Times and many other publications, and takes place on his RT television news program, On Contact.
On Contact.
Chris Hedges. Welcome to On Contact. Today we're going to be speaking with the courageous Israeli journalist, Amir Haas.
Look, there are things that Netanyahu, of course, is different than others. I think he and the generation of today's rulers have no shame.
Neoliberalism is patriotism. Truth is not. Utopian ideology of neoliberalism.
Revolt unmasked. On contact. Chris Hedges.
Israel has been poisoned by the psychosis of permanent war. It has been morally bankrupted by the sanctification of victimhood, which it uses to justify an occupation that rivals the brutality and racism of apartheid South Africa. Its democracy, which was always exclusively for Jews, has been hijacked by extremists who are pushing the country toward a form of fascism. Many of Israel's most enlightened and educated citizens, 1 million of them, have left the country. Its most courageous human rights campaigners, intellectuals and journalists, Israeli and Palestinian, are subject to constant state surveillance, arbitrary arrests, and government-run smear campaigns. Its educational system, starting in primary school, has become an indoctrination machine for the military and the growing intolerance, racism, and fanaticism, which always existed on the fringes of Israeli society, have moved into the political mainstream. Anya Parampil examines the public manifestations of racism that now characterize Israeli society.
In 1948, the United Nations partitioned historic Palestine into two states, an Arab state and a Jewish state known as Israel. Israel was founded by members of the Zionist movement who aimed to create an exclusively Jewish state in the majority Arab Palestine. And following its declaration of independence on May 15, 1948, an estimated 750,000 indigenous Palestinians were expelled from their homes by Zionist militias and made refugees. The day has become known as the Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe to the Palestinian people. In the aftermath of the Nakba, Israel passed two critical laws, the Absentee Property Act and the Infiltration Prevention Act. As part of the Zionist effort to preserve Israel's ethnic purity, the laws forbade the presence of Palestinian refugees from Israel and gave the government power to seize homes in Jerusalem, kicking families out. The goal of Israel from now on would be to keep the most amount of Jews on the most amount of land and the most amount of Palestinians on the least amount of land possible. Thanks to several military offensives and illegal Jewish settlement expansion, over the decades, the borders once drawn for Israel have disappeared, along with Palestinian-controlled land. Palestinians continuously resist this expansion, most notably during the First and Second Intifadas, or uprisings, the second of which ended in 2005 and turned violent as the occupation deepened and the Israeli military's tactics hardened. Under the current right-wing Likud party headed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the country has passed a slew of anti-democratic laws, including banning Nakba demonstrations, criminalizing the boycott of products from illegal settlements, and the creation of community acceptance laws, which actually allow neighborhoods to deny minorities residency. Israeli police are now also allowed to use sniper fire on child stone throwers. But considering the words of high-level Israeli politicians, perhaps these laws aren't so surprising. For example, during Israel's 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip in 2014, Education Minister Naftali Bennett responded to news of four Palestinian children blown up on the beach by the Israeli military by accusing them of, quote, self-genocide. Justice Minister Eilat Shaked has referred to all Palestinians as, quote, the enemy, and said in a Facebook post, Palestinian mothers should be killed to prevent them from, quote, giving birth to little snakes. And Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman declared last year that Palestinians disloyal to Israel should have their heads cut off. Perhaps the current state of Israel is best summed up in the words of former president of the Supreme Court, Aharon Barak. Israel is different from other countries. It's not only a democratic state, but also a Jewish state.
There are few Israeli journalists who have the courage and integrity of Amir Haas. She is the only Israeli journalist who has lived for prolonged periods of time and continues to live in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She is angered because of her uncompromising honesty, the Palestinian and Israeli leadership. The Israeli government has accused her of incitement to violence and had her arrested in 2009 after living in Gaza for several months for violating a law which forbids residents in an enemy state. Haas is the author of Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Days and Nights in a Land Under Siege. Please join me in conversation with one of the most intrepid and fearless reporters in Israel. Thank you, Amira.
Thank you, please.
Your awakening to the Palestinian condition, how did that happen?
Oh, that was quite early, I guess, because I was a red-diapered baby. So it's not...
Red-diaper baby?
My parents were in the Communist Party and Holocaust survivors, so it came very early. We won't start to go back that far.
But it's interesting because if you, like with Gideon Levy, another fine reporter, it really took his traveling within the occupied territories to change his understanding of what the occupation meant.
Yeah, I'm not that lucky, you know. Like I was born understanding that, almost born understanding, because I lived in I was part of a family that was, as I said, in the Communist Party, where there were Palestinian members, and we were at odds with the society around us. My father was arrested for several times while I was a child, and my mother was arrested. The police came to arrest my mother because she distributed leaflets against Ben Gurion. So it was not
Ben Gurion being the first
prime minister. So it's for me. I must say that I'm really not quite conservative in that sense.
Well, you were fortunate in your parents, let's put it that way.
I don't deplore having been, conservative in this way.
No, I was raised in the same household. It saved me a lot of time. I just want to look at, when I lived for 7 years in the Middle East, two of those years in Israel. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. You have that first generation, Ben Gurion being an example, but Abba Eban. Rabin came out of that. Teddy Kollek, the former mayor of Jerusalem. Many of these people born in Europe, not Rabin, but many of these people born in Europe, multilingual, highly educated. And the question was, how do you devolve to a Bibi Netanyahu or an Avigdor Lieberman? Or has the Zionist project always remained the same, hidden behind a different veneer?
Look, there are things that Netanyahu, of course, is different than others. I think he and the generation of today's rulers have no shame. In the times of Abba Eban, even Ben Gurion, they were hiding much.
Right.
They were not disclosing all what they were doing because still they were loyal to, or at least nominally, they were loyal to a set of values that they knew that they were violating in Israeli policies. So that's why they invented, if we make fast forward, that's why they invented with the occupation this notion of enlightened occupation. There is no enlightened occupation.
Well, they also carried out the brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing
of raising
in 1948, which is, let's face it, far worse than anything even Bibi Netanyahu has done.
Sure. Only that, let's say, 48 still, I think, if you look historically...
This is the founding of the state of Israel.
Yeah, it's 3 years after the end of the Second World War. It's, Zionism is seen, was until then not so much adopted by the majority of Jews. And all of a sudden, it was adopted by the by more Jews only when Hitler actually succeeded in eliminating a great part of the Jewish people in Europe. So the circumstances, historical circumstances, were slightly different, or not slightly different. Europe had 12 million refugees. So it was not, we're not talking about Europe that was a benign place, a great place to live. It just emerged from one of the lowest periods of time in its history. So, and there was war. I mean, you can find ways to explain it or to describe it. While 67, actually Israel established in 67 that it is a colonial state.
Well, this is when it took control of
Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Right.
Yes, yeah, in the
Well, you know, that you take that great Israeli moral philosopher, yes, who saw what everything was, but he would mark the occupation of 67 as really the end, unless Israel relinquishes the as the kind of end of Israel as a democratic or an open society. And he has been proven right.
Yes, and some would say, okay, also before Israel was democratic only because it got rid of the majority of Palestinians.
It was only democratic for Jews.
Yes, and then
always.
But you know, the thing is that if there is a chance to change, what are the chances? What are the opportunities we give ourselves to change?
Right.
And I think that the point where Israel showed that it does not change and that it is a colonial enterprise because it has so decided was with the Oslo Agreement.
Huh.
Because the Oslo in the 90s, the Oslo Agreement gave Israel a chance to cut loose from its colonialistic characteristics.
Right. Do you think that, and because some people, Miko Peled and others, argue that Oslo was just another trick.
It was. That's exactly, but not on the part of the Palestinians.
No, on the part of...
So on the part of Israel. So when the whole world is expecting Israel, you know, now you have South Africa, it's over, and you have the end of the Cold War, it's with the collapse of the Soviet system. So there was an expectation of a change also here.
On the part of the outside
on the part,
world, but not on the part of the Israeli leadership.
So what Israel did is just use it in all the tricks possible to do just the opposite.
Right.
And we are talking, you know, people said, Palestinians, the great majority of Palestinians, they said, okay, we give you a chance. Actually, they accepted, they actually gave Israel a present. They gave Israeli society a present, acknowledging that there was something, okay, that 48 was ethnic cleansing, as you said, but it was also the historiography of a persecuted people that found refuge in this country. You know, I'm sure that without Hitler and without the Holocaust, Israel would not have existed, or Zionism would not have succeeded the way it did.
Right.
But this is... So Palestinians actually came and told the Israelis, we acknowledge your being here, you being a society here. And then what Israel did is just the opposite, just rejected this very generous offer.
We're going to get back to that after this break.
On Contact, Chris Hedges.
Welcome back to On Contact. We're here with the Israeli journalist Amira Haas. So Amira, we spoke before the break a little bit about Oslo, 2,000-page document. But in brief, within that document, would you argue, because Israel retained control of the borders and essentially had a stranglehold on the economy, it was just a more sophisticated form of the occupation, or was there things in it that were more insidious than that?
Look, the main thing is that there is no mention of the goal of this so-called peace process.
Right.
So it doesn't state that the goal is two states.
Right.
So it is gradual. Okay, let's agree that you can withdraw gradually. But if you don't have a goal, what's gradual about it? Where to?
Right.
Then, of course, Israel maintained its control over the land and it was supposed to be temporary until 99, and we are in 2016, and Israel has managed from before Oslo, from 91 actually, to carve out the Palestinian territory, the would-be Palestinian state.
Well, they're taking more land.
Yes, and to create enclaves. So you have actually right. Palestinian reservations.
Right.
Gaza is the model, and then there is replicas in the West
right.
Bank,
kind of
which
plot,
is in front.
We should explain
yeah.
that what they've done, and I saw it on a UN map that yeah. a UN official gave me, is if you look at a map of the West Bank, It you're correct that it's kind of pod-like areas when you count the settlements, the ring
the
roads.
Area which Israel controls is 62% of the West Bank, and in between you have islands
right.
of Palestinian semi-sovereignty.
And let's touch on water yeah. here because it's an issue that's often not discussed, but it's crucial. Yeah. Israel, which you have pointed out, they cannot justify in the name of national security, has seized the aquifers.
Yeah, they use and they impose quota on the Palestinians. They, according to the agreement, about 80% of the aquifers in the West Bank, the water, is used by Israel, and 20% is for Palestinians, which is an outrage.
And you get whole
in Gaza,
in refugee camps, you get into houses where they don't have potable water coming out of the taps. They can't drink
the
water.
Not only there, you know, like refugee camps are sometimes are better off because they are being paid by others and they don't have to pay. No, you have in whole communities like in Hebron, all the summer they are in a special regime where they get water only once a week or once a month. Yes. And Gaza, which is even a worse crime, Gaza is taken as a should be self-sufficient with the water it has on its aquifer. So in 1948, before the plight and before it was filled with refugees, there were about 80,000 or 100,000 people, and the aquifer they used from the water of the aquifer, which was about 170, if I'm correct, million cubic meter, and it's the same amount today when you have almost 2 million people. So they are supposed to be to use the same water as if they were an island separated from the rest of the country. So instead of having an agreement where Palestinians can, or when Israel, instead of the water that it steals in the West Bank, gives direct to Gaza, then they are over pumping, and the 95% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable. They have to purify everything as if, you know, like in the worst places in the third world.
Let's talk about, because we're filming this in New York, you've been teaching at NYU, you're about to go back to Ramallah, which is in the West Bank, where you have been living and reporting. How, to outsiders, do you describe not only the occupation, but the evolution of the occupation in the years that you've been covering it?
The main thing is indeed this living in enclaves, that your psyche is getting used to living in enclaves, that there is semi or false or fake or quasi sovereignty, sense of quasi sovereignty within the enclaves under Palestinian policing power.
Yeah, what would you say? There's roughly about a half dozen in the West Bank. Would we call them these kind of Bantustans?
Let me say it's about seven. I mean, you have Gaza. I mean, you have Jenin. You have Nablus. You have Tulkarem. You have Qalqilya. You have Ramallah. You have Hebron. You have Bethlehem.
So we should be clear that one of the things the Israelis do is they make it very difficult to travel between these enclaves.
It's now it's different. I mean, with one of the successes of the World Bank and USAID or whatever was to guarantee that there is a contiguity, there is transportational contiguity. So you can theoretically you can go from Jenin and you can reach Ramallah, and you don't go through too many Israeli checkpoints. But at any moment, Israel can close the roads. At any moment, you can run into an Israeli
soldier. And
don't
they inhibit the trafficking of produce between?
Yes, but it's not as it used to be 10 years ago. This is not the issue. I mean, the issue is that you need, in order to develop, you need the space, you need
right.
the land, you need, you said the water, but not just the water. You want to build for example, land in Ramallah is ridiculously expensive because you cannot build in other places. So people are so land inside Ramallah became more expensive than New York in some places. Dunam, I don't know how much people pay. Maybe it's not more, but more than Tel Aviv. But you live in those enclaves and you feel that you are far 1 kilometer from an Israeli base or 3 kilometers from a settlement. And you get used to it because still it is better than living directly under Israeli occupation.
Well, you have your Quisling Palestinian Authority for...
I use milder word terms. I think it's not... I don't think that they did it from the beginning so consciously as he did. I mean, let's not exaggerate. But subcontractors, yes, you have subcontractors. But also not I mean, it's not just the subcontractors, but also there is a class in Palestinian society that right now they do not see any other horizon.
Right.
So they get used to this internal.
Is the Israeli tactic to reduce Palestinians to such a draconian subsistence level that all of their energy goes into just survival within these enclaves? Is that kind of the goal?
It might be true to say about Gaza, but about the West Bank, I think it would be wrong to explain it that way. It's not such a low subsistence. I mean, it is you have a middle class, you have opportunities to make money, you do have a growing Palestinian in certain places, bourgeoisie, you do have it. It's not, I mean, people are not on the verge of poverty, on the verge of starvation or hunger.
As we see in Gaza.
And even in Gaza, okay, this is thanks to the world, yes. And even in Gaza, I mean, you have the whole world paying money, which is hush money, in order not to force Israel to
open. Let's talk about what is this done to Israeli society. I mean, when I was in Israel, which was many years ago, you had figures like Meir Kahana, the right-wing Jewish extremist, spewing racist...
He's a mainstream now.
Yes, that's exactly the point. He's mainstream now, in figures like Avigdor Lieberman, even Netanyahu. What's happened? I mean, to what's happened to Israeli democracy? The Israeli state has been quite harsh with you.
With me?
Sure.
Not compared to what they do
to the Palestinians, but they've...
Yeah, it's... you know, when you said I was arrested, I was detained for a few hours. It's not... still, I say we have democracy for Jews. It is changing, of course, but not that dramatically. Like any society that has privileges, or any group that has privileges, and it's overstepping and you want to preserve your privileges, and those who are underprivileged fight against these privileges, then you have to justify all your ways of controlling and repression by theories of racist theories. I think this is true about many places in the world, if not all, where you have privileges. So you men have privileges, so they will develop ideas about inferiority of women in order to safeguard. And so it is, and the more we have privileges, and the more it is clear that it is at the account of the Palestinians, and the more it is at the account of any prospect for change and fairness, if not justice, in the country, the more Israeli society have to explain it by racist terms, and that these are Arabs, and these are... they do not deserve it, and they don't need it, and they are better off with us.
Doesn't this have, I mean, I think arguably it does have ramifications internally within Israel. You're seeing, and we'll close with this increasing suppression of Israeli human rights groups, journalists such as yourself, that sure. Disease has now come back to
eat. This is normal. I mean, in a way... maybe surprisingly late, but yes, they address. Look, they address the Israeli human rights organization and anti-occupation organizations, those that focus on the settlements, and the settlements embody this notion of Israeli privileges.
Right.
Of course, in the very fact that you can move there in the get land for...
And that is the policy, constant building. I mean, the last time I was in East Jerusalem, the first time I was in East Jerusalem was 1988. It doesn't even look like the same city anymore.
Sure, and the West Bank. So like a group such as Ta'ayush is a target of both the government and settlement organizations. Groups such as Breaking the Silence,
right,
which is focusing on the occupation and the settlements. So they are being targeted. Yes, and the Israelis go with it. The general Israeli right. public, because they are afraid. The Israeli society, Israel used to be a welfare state. Since the 70s, there was an attack on Israeli welfare state. And with the erosion of the withering away of the Israeli welfare state, there is a substitute, and this is in the occupied territory,
right.
The settlements.
There. Thank you, Amira. The Israeli religious scholar and moral philosopher, Yeshayahu Leibowitz, once wrote that religious nationalism is to religion what national socialism was to socialism. Leibowitz, who died in 1994, understood that the blind veneration of the military, especially after the 1967 war, where Israel captured the West Bank and East Jerusalem, was dangerous and would lead to the ultimate destruction of Israeli democracy. He foresaw, as he said, that the Arabs would be the working people and the Jews, the administrators, inspectors, officials, and police, mainly secret police. He feared that a virulent racism would consume Israeli society. He knew that prolonged occupation of the Palestinians would spawn concentration camps for the occupied, and that, in his words, Israel would not deserve to exist, and it will not be worthwhile to preserve it.
That was a conversation with Ramira Haas and Chris Hedges, originating on the RT television program On Contact. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
We are in Santa Cruz and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Stay tuned next for Project Censored.
Welcome to the Project Center show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon. Mickey and Peter will return in 2 weeks. On today's program, we will discuss Islamophobia, racism, and resistance in our fascist regime. Our guests are Michelle Rodino Colasino of Union for Democratic Communications, Caitlin Reams of The Incorruptibles and Brand New Congress, and activist and artist Charlotte Hill O'Neill, a.k.a. Mama C. Please stay with us.
Vitalized, alibis, skies, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my guest, my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. So, today is the general strike, February 17, 2017. People in 100 cities are participating in the strike for democracy. The organizer said that they're organizing this strike in reaction to the ICE raids, travel bans, Trump's mobilization on the border wall, as well as the attack of workers and women, people of color, the LGBTQ community, and our environment. So it's a pretty wide scope. This is kind of looks like it's an attempt at the big umbrella movement the progressive organizations have talked about for quite some time. What news are you guys hearing about this?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the use of the term strike, because not only does it is it reminiscent of some of the movements in the left in Europe, but it also is an all-encompassing term, as you suggest, that where we can take on wide-ranging issues like anti-immigration policies of the Trump administration, the critique of the media, all kinds of things that are going on. But we can also begin to incorporate what I think is going to start happening in this country, which is, at least I'm hoping it will happen in this country, the rise of a new labor movement, especially as we begin to see the Trump administration and others pushing back against union organizing and pushing that right to work legislation.
And we already saw yesterday, the Day Without Immigrants, that made quite a splash nationwide. I think that was a pretty nice precursor to a more general strike, given as well with the policies coming down with Trump's new National Guard announcements trying to get rid of more immigrants to the country. How about if immigrants just go on strike and show their economic and political muscle?
Okay, well, we're lucky enough to actually have Michelle Rodino-Colasino from the Union for Democratic Communication. She's been active and participating in this movement. And so I believe we can get just a couple minutes of talking with her. So, Michelle, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, it's nice to hear from you.
All right, fantastic to hear from you. Great to be here.
Yes. So we're talking a little bit about the Strike for Democracy. What can you tell our listeners? What's going on? How's it organized and how's it going?
Yeah, well, it's very loosely organized. It's going great. There are large events going on in New York, in L.A., in D.C., in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia, in other places around the country. There's over 100 of various events. Some of them are strikes. Some of them are demonstrations. People are doing boycotts and bycotts, teach-ins, Skillshares. It's just really a patchwork and a quilt. And it's really neat. It really bubbled up from below, with all of these people kind of finding each other on social media and making plans.
Can you talk a little bit about that? So, this is such a broad scope, that this is attempting to look at. Who are some of the organizations that are participating in this movement?
Right. Well, this is a beautiful thing as well that, Women's March, and International Women's Day, are both actually officially partnering with Strike for Democracy, which is the event that's happening today, and also a larger group. We're kind of hoping that Strike for Democracy becomes a movement, not a moment. I know that a lot of people are saying that for various movements, including Black Lives Matter and others. But we really hope that this will become a coalition, even including Black Lives Matter. But for now, Women's March and Women's Day, are both in solidarity for today's small action that's also hoping to be kind of an energizing moment, even a moment to kind of get together with people, ask for people's contact information and see if they're ready to plan for an even larger mass strike. The next one being March 8th, A Day Without a Woman. And again, that's the mass strike being planned by Women's Day and Women's March.
Michelle, this is Michael Levitin hopping in. What do you see as the momentum or the new kind of openness to this idea of a general strike? It's so...
Right. It's fantastic. And as I was waiting there listening, I was listening to you talking about how this might be an indication of a new labor movement. And I do think that it is. I think people are waking up. You might have heard the word, the phrase stay woke. I think people are waking up to the fact that they have power more than just at the ballot box, which unfortunately is sometimes taken away. There was, we saw in this last election the purging of millions of votes, the right to vote of millions of African Americans and Latina and Latinos and Asians. If you're familiar at all with Greg Palast's investigative journalism on the vote purge. So people are feeling, beyond voting, there's other powers I have, even beyond marching and demonstrating. And one of them, a classic one, is the strike.
And have unions really, or labor and organizers, organizations been brought in, like, say, dock workers and other, you know, actual unions that could have put more muscle into this, or is that maybe coming up in the months ahead?
Well, yeah, we're hoping that that's coming up in the months ahead. And as I'm sure some of your listeners are aware, there are laws like Taft-Hartley which make it illegal for unions to strike in solidarity, you know, to do secondary strikes. So that really, you know, Taft-Hartley was really designed in the mid-40s to end general strikes. And after that, labor had to get more creative for the great sit-down strikes that were effective. You know, auto industry did those and, you know, slowdowns and other actions. So I think what's happening today is just another kind of move in the development of creative actions people can take at work. You know, they can tweet during their lunch breaks. They can have a sick day. I know that some people actually asked their bosses to stay home, and their bosses were very supportive. We saw yesterday with Day Without an Immigrant, some restaurants actually closed, you know, the management, you know, kind of being a leading force of that. so it's kind of a different, you know, we're at a different point in time than we were, you know, in the 40s and the 30s and the teens when we saw general strikes last. So, yeah, it's really exciting. So hopefully we'll go forward, and hopefully going forward, you know, unions and kind of what we, when we say big labor, we'll see, you know, large unions being able to mobilize their members. But, of course, it takes a lot of planning, right, for that to happen. And this plan to have F-17, February 17 happen was really kind of thought of and just really a few weeks ago. So it's quite amazing that this just was able to happen, just given about 2 weeks of planning of really of people desperately doing a thing.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We are recording this program on February 17th, the day of this general strike. And we are talking to Michelle Rodino-Colosino about the strike. Michelle, earlier you had talked about social media, and we always sort of hear these absolutes about how it's either the worst thing that's ever happened or the greatest thing that's ever happened. So I'm wondering, what's the importance of social media in organizing something like this large general strike?
Right, right. Yeah, well, I've seen this be both kind of the best of times and worst of times for organizing. The, you know, social media is wonderful for making it easy for people to reach out and find each other, but the rub is you have to be on social media. So you're going to see a class of more privileged people, English-speaking people, and so you can't really easily organize people if they're not on Facebook and on Twitter or on Instagram, right? And so you're automatically cutting out some of the most vulnerable workers right there. And maybe people who don't speak English, you know, as the first language they speak and all of that. So, I think it's a tool. I think it's a way to get started and get the ball rolling. And we just kind of have to keep going from there.
So, Michelle, what can you tell our listeners? What can people do to get involved in this either today or for March 8th or any other movements coming off of this moving forward? What would you recommend for listeners?
Right. That's a great question. I would say one of our kind of slogans has been find your people, make your plan. I think you can use the many events today, even live stream events. There have been live stream events hosted by People for Bernie. I think Women's March is hosting a live stream, and Brave New Films is as well. If you jump on Facebook, sorry again, just have to advertise Facebook and say that, but you can find some live streams, or if you go to our website, Strike for Democracy. And the reason I'm saying that is, you know, you can kind of get a sense of like who's involved. And if you can't find people locally to get involved with, you can take a look around. And maybe, you know, contribute just kind of like in the comment section or register on one of those social media sites under a group maybe that's near you. Now, if you do live somewhere and there's an action that's still going on, I would say get out there. Get out there and go to that action, whether it's a demonstration or a teach-in or a film or a bike ride. There's some of those happening. And then sign in. We've been encouraging people to ask for people's names and contact information so they can be part of the next wave of action. So, for example, I teach out here at Penn State. We had a small demonstration, and I explained to people what we were doing today and how we were hoping to build momentum for March 8th. And if they'd like to be part of that and help plan, if I could have their name and emails and their phone numbers, and everybody gladly gave it because they all want to be part of the Day Without a Woman being planned for March 8th. So I would say that's kind of the next step. If you can't get to an event right now, just look online and you know, try to reach out to somebody. We'll all take your emails. And if nothing else, you can always sign up at Strike for Democracy. We have a place where you can just register as an individual. So strikefordemocracy.com or strikefordemocracy.org.
Michelle, this is Dr. Baham. I wanted to ask you, I had a sense during the Women's March that there was this possibility of us as activists overcoming the balkanization of traditional Democratic Party politics. And personally, I'm very prepared as a black man to be Latino, to be Muslim, to be a black male feminist. And I'm wondering if there's any sense with the organizing of the general strike that we're continuing to push in this kind of direction.
So I think what you're asking is, are we approaching this kind of intersectionally?
Correct. Yes.
Coalition? And
yes.
The answer is yes. Now, I have to say, I've seen a lot of white faces involved with today, and I hope that changes, and I hope that's more of an expression of the fact that a lot of people were mobilized on Facebook and says more about Facebook's demographics and Twitter's demographics than the demographics of the people that want to organize and need to organize. So I think that's going to be fine, and I think we are. I know a lot of us have been reaching out to various groups. Women's March in and of itself is a coalition, right? It's a vast coalition of 500 partners. And in working with Women's March, it's been really wonderful to see that they, you know, Women's March has ties with labor, with Black Lives Matter, with community organizing groups that, you know, are intersectional. So it's sort of like coalescing with a coalition right there. So I think, but everybody that showed up, I have to say, having said that, at my event, which again, I saw a lot of white people at, we had all different kinds of signs. We had signs for women's rights. We had a Black Lives Matter sign. We had, signs, people from LGBT movements coming out. So it's really been a gratifying day.
Okay, Michelle, thank you for coming on the radio show today, and I know you're busy doing a ton of things. We really appreciate you having you on. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been really wonderful. Like I said, if anyone out there wants to get signed up or just find out more about what we're doing, check out our website, strikefordemocracy.com and strikefordemocracy.org.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. We will be back after this short musical break.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, no matter what? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, no matter what?
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listen and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been working, I'm the giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple and Oaxaca, and we hold the machete. I rock hard like Palestinian children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid.
Okay, welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with our co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. Now we're going to switch over and talk about our headlines. As everyone knows, the Media Freedom Foundation does a bunch of work through the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, as well as ProjectCensored.org, and we like to highlight the great work that's being done. So Alicia Guajardo, our intern, is here. And Alicia, what's in the news?
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I am Alicia Guajardo with the Media Freedom Foundation. Here are just some of the stories we're working on for you. Professor Watchlist, a racist violation of free speech by Peter Phillips. In this article, Dr. Phillips breaks down the racist implications of a list of professors created by Turning Point USA. This can be found at projectcensored.org. Also,
actually, Dr. Phillips does some incredible work on breaking down these lists, this list culture we're in now of, we'll just make a list of things not to pay attention to, like the Washington Post news list or these conservative lists of professors who hate America. And I have had a chance actually to read this article, and it's a really good article. He shows that basically if you're anyone who fights for racial equality or critical race theorists, you're definitely going to end up on this list. Okay, Alicia, what else do you have for us?
Okay, so at jcml.org, that is the Global Critical Media Literacy Project's website, Caitlin Ramsey, who's a student at Worcester State University, working with Dr. Julie Frechette, they published an article titled Victoria's Real Secret, Perfect Body Campaign. In the article, it argues that more than any other sociocultural force, corporate media defines one's body image, which is the idea of what one's body is or should be like. In fact, the American ideal of beauty has become so pervasive that 50% of 3 to 6 year old girls worry about their weight. There are 30 million people of all ages and genders that suffer from an eating disorder in the United States. And according to the National Association of Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders, and out of these 30 million people, women make up 90% of that populace. Eating disorders tend to start in the teenage years, but can also start at the ripe old age of 8. And 80% of 10-year-old girls have dieted. Young girls are more afraid of being fat than they are of nuclear war, getting cancer, or even losing their parents. Why at such a young age do people develop such a devastating mentality?
Yeah, this article from Dr. Julie Frechette's student, Caitlin Ramsey, is a really good one that I think she does a great job of displaying the negative effects of media. Sometimes people, you know, question why are you so critical of media, but you know, these are individuals who are changing all of their life choices, adding on these fears because of what they're seeing in media. So definitely a really important read, and I can just say Dr. Julie Frechette is someone I've had the privilege of working with, does some amazing work, as do her students. So I would check that out at gcml.org.
And also at gcml.org, Steve McCombs of California Maritime Academy, working with our host, Nolan Higdon, published Global Epidemic of Electronic Waste. The article discusses the epidemic of pollution and environmental degradation concerning electric waste, including how electronic waste, when recycled improperly, negatively affects local communities across the globe.
Yeah, this is this article was a pleasure to work on because Steve McComb's a great student, but also really sad reality to face, especially as we go through these more and more iPhones that are come out and people throw away their old products. This is creating waste around the globe, and I think part of that discussion about media literacy, something I've been an advocate for, is we can't just discuss how to use these tools. We also need to look at the implications, not just on people's social norms, but also the environment of using these digital tools as well. All right, what else do you have for us?
Okay, and finally, the educators and conscious consumers in our audience can visit gcml.org and find a free resource for educators and consumers, media literacy, to assess and evaluate news and current events. Published by Dr. Allison Butler of Mass Media Literacy, the packet titled Post-Election, Post-Truth, using comprehensive media literacy, critical media literacy skills to evaluate the current post-election news environment, including fake news, satire, and propaganda. It is primarily designed for librarians, but the document can be adapted for anyone interested in applying critical media literacy activities to support students, families, and community patrons as well.
I want to say that Dr. Allison Butler does some phenomenal work, and you'll notice that a lot of folks use the term media literacy, but her and the others I work with use the term critical media literacy. And the reason that critical is so important because it allows us to ask questions of power. Who has the power to create media? Who's consuming media? Who has the power to disseminate media? And a lot of, you know, media literacy educators tend to take foundation funding from like Nickelodeon, Sony, Apple, and Microsoft. So they want to teach students how to use these tools and rely on them. Or critical scholars are questioning about these power dynamics and its implications and what sort of dogma it's promoting through the usage of these tools. So a really great piece to check out at gcml.org if you get a chance.
Thank you, everyone. I'm Alicia Wajardo, and that is the news that did not make the news.
All right. Alicia, great work. All right, we're going to take a short musical break. When we come back, we are going to talk to Caitlin Remmel.
She's on air now.
Oh, Caitlin's on the air. Caitlin's on the air now. That's what happens when I don't pay attention. All right, so Caitlin's on the air. Caitlin's on the air now.
Hi, Caitlin. This is Michael Levitin. We're going to introduce you real brief, briefly here. Caitlin, you have been working with Brand New Congress. I think the people and numerous other organizations, and you were involved with the Bernie Sanders campaign here. In fact, you introduced him at one of his rallies in the Bay Area. So welcome to the show. And I think why don't you start by telling people what is going on with Brand New Congress currently, which you are involved in.
Great. Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, Brand New Congress is really just, if anything, it's a really exciting experiment that we are trying with this political revolution that we have going on in our country right now. What our goal is we're targeting the year 2018, and we're running a slate of 400-plus candidates for Congress with the idea that everyone is on a unified progressive platform, and we'll be running it from the national strategical level, but with 400-plus different heads, different specific races. And these are the people we will be running are local leaders of their community. So the idea is that we're trying to re-elect Congress with people that are actual, real representatives of their community and people who actually want to fight for their constituents and do what's best for the country.
Right. Now, Caitlin, so just to clarify for people, so really this movement, Brand New Congress, it grew out of, what was it, just pre-Trump election, or was it right around the election when essentially people got together and said, which they've been saying now for years, which is that this Congress does not work for the people. There is money in politics. There is immense corruption. It is a Tea Party kind of fueled momentum that has taken over and pretty much wants to disembowel our government more than establish any kind of regulations or help rein in corporate power. What was the idea really behind Brand New Congress to basically replace and say, They all need to go? I mean, there are progressives, there's other good ones there, but what was the fundamentals of this group when it started?
Yeah, so really, one of the fundamentals is really actually what you touched on, which is the corrupt money and the corrupt politicians that we have just throughout our entire government. And so by running candidates that are picked not only by the people, but then also funded by the people, all through small dollar donations, we are not a super PAC. We are just a regular federal regulated PAC that has a lot of limits and regulations on donations. So we are funded completely by the people. So then the candidates would actually, when they're in office, be fighting for their constituents. So that's really what we are based on originally, is this idea is inspired by the Bernie Sanders campaign, being able to find an honest politician that is genuine and cares about the people that he's representing. We just took a look at that and realized we want more of that. We want more people like that in our Congress and in our federal government. And regardless of who is in the White House, we need to have a strong Congress behind them to really be working for the people, because not one person can do it alone.
Caitlin, this is Dr. Baham. I'm wondering, even when we find good candidates and people who are representing the values of the people in this country, how do we manage to get these people elected in sort of a post-Civil Rights Act world that we're in, post-Voting Rights Act in particular? This election that we just had is the first election that we've had since the passage of the Voting Rights Act, in which the Voting Rights Act itself was neutered.
Sure. So, to be honest, one of the ways that we can really accomplish this is by spreading the word now and getting just a huge turnout for our midterm elections, because the reality is when we're looking at voter fraud, when we're looking at all of the corrupt money that is used to spend on campaigns, the reality is that voter turnout can really help to overcome any of this. And so when enough people are showing up at the polls to vote for the candidate that they really want in office, it really does show that we can overcome anything. The other thing that's really exciting is when we're looking at 400 races, like if we look at just with the Bernie campaign during the primaries, he won, over 20 states throughout the country. He won by a landslide in so many districts. So if we can just get some of our candidates elected just in those specific districts. I mean, even if we can just get a handful of 30 of our candidates elected in 2020 in 2000 18, then that will really, really go a long way and just help us build even more momentum to continue every 2 years to continue with this fight.
Kaylin, this is Dr. Nolan Higdon. I was kind of on a similar point that you're talking about here. From my experience in studying media, people tend to not want to discuss or look at voter fraud. It scares people because it reveals some scary foundations of our democratic process. And so I'm just wondering, as an organization, do you guys take that into account? Like, how do we expose this, make people aware of it, and then, of course, resist it and combat it? So is that a center anywhere in your guys' purview of trying to change the way Congress behaves?
Great question. I think the biggest way that we want to look at combating it, and yes, we definitely do talk about it, and it's something that's brought up a lot, if anything, just by our supporter base. And I think really what a lot of our vision is and our goal is that even if voter fraud is not specifically in our platform, just same with the way that voting is regulated and campaign spending or anything like that, our goal is that by getting these candidates into office who are, again, want to actually represent the will of the people, they will make the right decisions and come together as a group to make any laws or reform that needs to be changed in our system. So the biggest way that right now that we want to look at overcoming it is by having that turnout, having that amount of landslide support that we really need. And then in addition, once we actually get our candidates in office, then they will be able to put some things in place to actually make those changes far more lasting.
So, Kaylin, it sounds so straightforward. It sounds real, like what so many people in the country are saying. It's what Trump's election has now driven people to this conclusion, if the Tea Party elections before it didn't already, which is we need our own people in office. We need to take back government and take back Congress. What?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but so it sounds like a straightforward thing. What are these candidates? How do you put out the the notice? What is the message you send for the kind of people? I mean, if you want to have Bernie type people that say who are decades younger and who will be in office for many years, hopefully, and who come and represent, say, even the millennial generation and people in their 20s and 30s, you don't have to have folks who are, I mean, I think it's really looking for young, new blood to come in. But what's the strategy to find those people and encourage them to step up?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing is we are asking the country to nominate people in their communities. So we have asked our supporter base, we are throughout the country, we have gotten well over 5,000 nominations, if not higher, higher number than that at this point over the last several months. So we're asking our supporter base and just everyone possible to nominate someone that they think of that they would love to be the person representing them in Congress. And then from there, we have a strong vetting process that our working group is looking at these nominations, looking at demographically, if this person is a good representative of their community, looking at what have they been able to build in their community, what are ways that they have stood up to corruption or bureaucracy in the past, and then in addition, what industries that they have been a part of, and then of course also what are their political views as well in terms of how progressive they are. What's nice is by looking at this slate of 400 candidates, we're compiling this this large puzzle of people, we're going to be able to look at, great, what are we looking at in terms of demographics, in terms of race and age and industries that people have experience in, as well as religion, as well as gender. And so across the board, we're hoping to put together a slate of candidates that demographically is actually representative of our country, because we have right now we've been able to identify all of the districts where there are a lot of white male Republican Christian men in our Congress right now, and not that that's a bad thing by any means, because we definitely have plenty of those types of citizens throughout the country. But it is proportionately not accurate right now, and it is not a good representation of what actually makes our country up.
Yeah, and what's so? Tell me also, tell listeners what Justice Democrats. What is this new fusion that's taken place with brand new Congress and the Young Turks, I believe, from the media organization with Cenk Uygur? What is that, Justice Democrats?
Yes, so basically Justice Democrats comes from the idea, the fundamental anger that a lot of people have had, specifically with the Democratic Party and how corrupt the Democratic Party has been, with everything when it comes to voter fraud and being very dishonest and just corrupt throughout. And so a lot of people are looking at, just specifically on the Democratic side, how can we take back the party? Because it's a party that is supposedly supposed to be working for the people. So where brand new Congress is postpartisan and will be planning to run both Republicans and Democrats, depending on what makes sense for the district, there's a lot of people that really just want to be focused on the Democratic side of the race and rebuilding the party. So that's where Justice Democrats has come into play, and Justice Democrats has formed with this idea of building a slate of candidates specifically on the Democratic side to really infiltrate and take back the party so that it's working for the people. So Justice Democrats and brand new Congress have formed a very close partnership. And so the Democratic candidates that are put forward by brand new Congress will be endorsed in the same as the Justice Democrats candidates as well. So we're working together with the nomination, so we're not getting in each other's way. So wherever we overlap, we are sharing resources. I actually personally volunteer for both. We have a lot of volunteers that are working with both organizations.
That's wonderful. Caitlin, can you give the website where people can go to so they can find out and plug in?
Absolutely. JusticeDemocrats.com. Is where you can go to look up that. And then in addition, we have brandnewcongress.org. You can nominate candidates, you can have a chance to donate, or you can fill out a survey that tells us about your community, so that way we can make sure that we're actually finding representatives that represent their communities accurately.
Excellent. Thank you, Caitlin Rimmel. Very appreciated with brand new Congress and other organizations. Appreciate you coming on.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifico Radio, and we will return after this short musical break. Back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon, in the studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin.
At this time, we want to welcome Charlotte Hill O'Neill, a.k.a. Mama C. She's a visual artist and spoken word artist, musician, longtime community activist, a former Black Panther, and co-director of United African Alliance Community Center, the UAACC, that is based in Tanzania, East Africa. Welcome to the Project Censored Radio Show, Mama C.
Thank you so much.
It's very good to hear your voice. For people who are just getting familiar with you, we want to give you a little bit of time to sort of explain your beginnings in the Black Panther Party.
Yes, yes. Well, I was born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas, and was always interested in African history. And then in the late 60s, I started hearing about the Black Panther Party here in Kansas City. Started seeing things on TV and in the newspapers, and I even had cut out some articles and clippings and pasted them to the wall of my bedroom, and I never realized that I would actually meet, let alone become the wife of the founder of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party, Brother Pete O'Neill. So I started going to the political education classes, and then I started going to the Breakfast for School Children program, and then I signed on the dotted line. And, you know, before you join, you had to read certain books, and you had to learn certain things, and I passed all the tests and became a full-fledged member of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party.
And I know you have a very unique perspective on the international organization of the Black Panther Party. Could you share that a little bit with our audience?
Yes, yes. You know, I think most of your listeners know about COINTELPRO, which was the counterintelligence insurgency program that was initiated by the FBI, I think in the 50s. And there was a focus on the Black Panther Party and other progressive organizations in the 60s and early 70s, and many of the leaders were targeted and jailed and for things that they could not have done, and some were even killed. Well, my husband, Pete O'Neill, was one of the targeted leaders, and he was charged with carrying a gun across state lines. And anybody who knows about Kansas City knows that there is, in some places, there literally is a line in the middle of the road that separates Kansas City, Kansas, from Kansas City, Missouri. And there are so many hunters here, and everyone would cross state lines. But the thing about it is, he didn't do it. The thing about it is, they never even found him with this weapon. They never, they found another Panther with it, actually. It had been sold by the police and had to be bought back after he was brought to trial. So he was charged with this, carrying a gun across state lines. He was convicted. He was given four or five years, I don't remember, and then there were two other charges that were lined up. We decided to leave and thought we would be back in 2 years. You know, there was what I like to term a modern-day underground railroad in those days, where people all around the world would help Black Panthers, would help other revolutionaries to go into exile for whether it was going to be a short time, a short period, or a long time. Well, we had help on this modern-day underground railroad and left and ended up in Algeria, Algiers, Algeria, which was the site of the international section of the Black Panther Party and was founded by Brother Eldridge Cleaver and some other comrades who were there. We lived there for 2 years, and I tell you, brother, the camaraderie there was just beautiful. It was really, we were a family. It was very similar in all chapters of the Black Panther Party. No matter where you went, you were considered a comrade and family member. So here I was, what, 19 years old then, almost 20, living in a country that I knew nothing about, living in a different culture. It was an Islamic culture there. I knew nothing about that. But the fact that we had so much support from the Algerian government, the National Front for Liberation, and the fact that there were revolutionaries from all over the world there that we interacted with made it a very easy situation. Matter of fact, it was a beautiful situation. I learned so much there, and that's where our first child, Malcolm, was born, also in the hills of Medea, like 60 miles outside of Algeria. Yes.
You're listening to the Project Center show on Pacifica Radio. And we are talking to Mama C, and I am Dr. Nolan Higdon. And Mama C, a moment ago you spoke about the COINTEL program and how the government had created this infrastructure to blockade the successful activism and progressivism of the Black Panther Party. And I'm wondering what your view is, given today, how that infrastructure has dramatically expanded, especially in the digital era and the increase of the military state. Are you optimistic about still the people power to resist the regime's ability to surveil and manipulate the courts? And if you are optimistic, what is it that keeps you optimistic?
Wow. You know, this is a whole different ball game, of course, as you mentioned, because of the digital age. You know, I mean, we were working with mimeograph machines then. But, you know, that's a two-edged sword, I think, because people can use that to their advantage in order to reach more people on the social network. You know, and I maintain that as long as there are cadres of people in communities across America and across the world who still have progressive ideals, who still have the upliftment of their communities in their minds and in their hearts, I think that things will still improve. Maybe not on a large scale, but there are pockets of people, there are cadres of people who are taking, for instance, the education of their children into their own hands. You know, you have community schools, you have people who are homeschooling, you know, you have people who are looking at urban farming as a way to not only provide much needed food in these food deserts that are all across the country, but also as a means of building community, you know. So, yeah, I'll never give up hope. I will never give up hope. I think resistance will continue, but we do have to find other means.
Mama C, this is Michael Levitin hopping in. What would you say, responding to Black Lives Matter and their role, that group's role, couldn't quite call it a group or organization. It is a vast, it's a potential, really. I mean, it could go in so many ways, that movement. Where do you think that they could find the footing for that movement to help lead in this new Trump law and order period?
Well, you know, I say much respect and salute to Black Lives Matter and other progressive organizations like that. I mean, they are so, so needed. I think they are an example for so many people. They have awakened so many people, and because of this, call it a military state, because of that, it has forced people to come together, to wake up, to educate each other, to resist, you know. So organizations like Black Lives Matter continue to be needed, and I think that there will be tentacles of that organization, of that movement, that will spread to other communities. And, you know, I think they're setting a very, very good example.
You know, I wanted to ask you along those lines, this is Dr. Bayham again, to the degree to which you as a Black Panther soldier feel that the Black Lives Matter movement is a natural outgrowth of the Black Panther Party. And in particular, I'm thinking about the sort of Black queer woman activist who is at the head, who are at the heads of many of the Black Lives Matter chapters. If you see that as an outgrowth of the activism of Black women in the Black Panther Party, like yourself.
Of course it is, because, you know, that was one of our tenets, that we work with everybody. Everyone had the right to progress in their lives and to build their lives. And back in the day, it wasn't that popular to recognize, you know, the queer community, but the Black Panther Party always did. The way we recognized everyone and the way we work with everyone. You know, when I go to these different schools, I always like to emphasize the fact that, you know, the news media tried to depict us as a racist organization, where we were anything but that. You know, we worked with all progressive people to build our community. Of course, our focus was on our Black community, but we understood that we do have allies, whether they were in the white community, red community, brown community, or yellow community, or the purple community, the queer community, you know. So to me, that doesn't even factor into it, the fact that it is was started by some queer sisters, you know. If you have your head on right, if your heart is in the right place, then I say right on to that.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We will be back with Mama C after this short musical break.
Ooh, la, 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 la. Ooh, la, 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 la.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon, in studio with my co-hosts, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III, and our senior correspondent, Michael Levitin. We are talking to Mama C.
Mama C, this is Dr. Bayham again. I know that you're back in the United States for another national tour, and we're going to be speaking about the United African Alliance Community Center. We wanted to give you a little bit of an opportunity to talk about the things that you're going to be sharing with the audiences that you encounter during your current national tour.
Well, you know, I always like to speak on the history of the Black Panther Party and how it was such a means to uplift the community and join us together. But I love to focus also on the fact that in Tanzania, at the United African Alliance Community Center, or you can say UAACC, that we're carrying on the work of the Black Panther Party, the community service of the Black Panther Party, and we are so proud of that, that we've been able to do that for more than 40 years, despite the fact that Brother Pete continues to be in exile. And I always like to tell people that the fact that we're able to do that, the fact that we have been able to continue that community service, to me, that is the greatest revenge.
So, Mama C, where can people go to find out about the specific dates of where you'll be, and what can they expect when they go out to see you?
Well, I will be posting that on my Facebook page and on our website, which is at www.uaacc.net. But I haven't posted yet. I will be doing that very, very soon. My Facebook page is very active. That's Charlotte Hill O'Neill, and people can find out a lot about that. I also, you know, I'm a musician also, and I'm a poet. So I have a lot of my work on SoundCloud, a lot of my work on YouTube, and I'm a filmmaker also. I'll be showing a couple of films, not only that I have made myself, but films that have been about our work, including one, A Panther in Africa, by Aaron Matthews. People can see that on PBS TV also. And another one called A Mama C, Urban Warrior in the African Bush, by Dr. Joanne Hirschfield.
Mama C, wondering if there's any chance that you have any of your poetry that you'd be willing to share with us at this moment.
Yes. You know, as a matter of fact, I was looking through my book right now. So as we talk, let me continue looking for something that isn't too long, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time.
That sounds good. So while you're looking, too, you know, maybe you can find something that is particularly relevant to the conversation that that we've had up to this point. I haven't actually directly asked you about your take on a topic that we've been discussing quite a bit today, that is the rise of American authoritarianism in the Trump era.
You know, it's blowing my mind. It really is. You know, during the campaign, I just, very naively, I just really, really thought that he would not be elected. You know, and I kept saying this is just a distraction, you know, and they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes as something else is going on. And now he's really here. You know, and people who voted for him, I think they're saying, oops, we made a big mistake, you know. And I just really, in my heart, I don't think that he's going to last much longer as far as being able to govern. It's just too many discrepancies in what he's trying to do. And people are really waking up, people in Congress and I guess people in the Senate. You know, so it's blowing my mind that this has really happened. And, you know, a lot of your listeners have probably read the book 1984, you know, and we're really living in the era of 1984, of George Orwell's 1984, you know. But like I said before, in many ways, this causes people to come together, you know. So we have to always, like Obama used to say, we have to always take the high road, you know, and look for ways that we can turn this negative situation into something that is positive.
Mama C, this is Michael Levitin again. What I don't know if you were tuned in this week. I mean, Donald Trump's assertions at a large press conference, talking about the Congressional Black Caucus, and sort of he seemed pretty caught out. I guess he'd been trying to arrange some meetings, but the caucus didn't want to meet with him. They hadn't really had much success at communication. And the interviewer, the journalist in the audience, said, you know, what really is your plan? Are you going to follow through? Because really, he seems to be telling America, and of course, many of us know not to believe the vast majority of what he's telling us, but he seems to think that Black America really did, in largish numbers, larger than we expected, as he says, voted for him, and somehow expects Trump to come out and play and take the side of what he calls our, you know, our carnage-ridden inner cities. What he plans to do is a mystery to anyone. I mean, do you see it as his case is just disingenuous and, again, pulling the wool over? Or do you think he has anything to offer?
Yeah, I really don't. I really, really, really don't. And that's very, very sad. You know, he doesn't have anyone on his team that would have the interests of not only Black people, but any of the communities that he is supposed to serve in his focus. You know, any upliftment of communities. And when I look at who the education, the person who's the head of the education, did she get elected? I mean, did she get appointed? I
think her Betsy DeVos is in, yes.
With an unprecedented vote cast by the vice president, had never happened in U.S. history to break the tie.
You know, that's some scary stuff right there, especially when you look at one of the first things that they started doing was taking away funds for all these urban schools and taking away funds for the art programs and things like that. You know, it's all by design. It's all by design. It's all to destroy the communities, the little bit of things that are left. And that is so sad. But on the other hand, this is forcing people to start homeschooling their children. It's forcing people to start their own community schools. You know, but I saw on the internet recently that this sister had taken her child out of school to homeschool her child, and the authorities came, arrested her, put the child in foster care, and I think she's locked up. I couldn't believe it.
Yes. Mama C, we may have actually run out of time for a poem from you, but we've been able to give our listeners... do we have at least 1 minute, Nolan?
We have 1 minute. We have a little part.
Mama C, maybe a stanza.
I have a short something, okay?
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, we are the knowers. We are the dreamers, and we are the soars, indigo children, the teachers and the preachers. We are the chosen, we are the artists, and we are the seekers, and we walk the way of the new world. Yeah, that's what we do.
Thank you so much, Mama C.
It's amazing. Thank you so much for being on the program. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Y'all take care here.
You too.
All power to the people.
Power to the people.
Aye. Bye-bye.
Hi. Okay, you've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Michael Leverton, our senior correspondent. Our interns, Alicia Hardo and Desiree McSwain. Anthony Fest is our producer, and Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook, and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all our radio radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, those of our children, and those looming down the road and not that far into the distance. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. Well, I want to jump into today's program, but I realize I have to take my hat off, if I were wearing one, in sad recognition that Mr. Puzder, the ostensible next labor secretary in our government, has withdrawn in this last week, and later in the program we'll come back and talk a little bit about why that is and what it might mean. I also want to begin by making a comment that several of you have asked me about. Is it correct that the stock market has done well since Mr. Trump's election? The answer is unequivocally, yes, it has. It has done very nicely. I wouldn't say it has soared, but it has done really quite well. It broke the 20,000 mark, which was considered significant on the Dow Jones in Washington and in New York City, too. So it tells us something. And what it tells us, I believe, is the following. Yes, there might be all kinds of drama and chaos in Washington with the transition of the government. Yes, there might be all kinds of people around the country suffering, angry, upset, bewildered, and a whole host of other adjectives I could come up with. But for the people who run this economy, the big businesses, the corporate executives, they see good news, and the rich people who invest in them, likewise. And here's what they see. A Trump government that is going to have to work things out with the Republican majority in both houses, and the one, maybe the two things they most agree on is to deregulate American business, that is, make it freer for them to make money, and to lower the taxes on American business, basically across the board. Even if a few are raised, others will be lowered to offset it. And so that's why the businesses and the investors are happy, even if many of you listening are not. And that tells you a lot about who this economy serves and who this government serves and who it does not. So let me turn then to the segments I've prepared for this week's economic update. I want to begin by acknowledging a remarkable thing that happened this last week in Switzerland. Why would I be talking to you about Switzerland? Well, as I tell you the story, you'll see that it applies to the United States, too, in a remarkable way. So here's what happened in Switzerland. Switzerland is a federal country. That is, it has cantons, things we would here call states or regions. Cantons are the subdivisions of the state, of the government of Switzerland. And the cantons have been busy doing what political authorities all over the capitalist world are busy doing most of the time. And that is trying to get corporations to come to wherever they are. And the way they do that is to lower taxes on them. They get the incentive going. That is, the companies are told, here, come to Switzerland rather than be in Belgium or Italy or Britain or anywhere in the world, because we will tax you less. Yes, Switzerland has a federal tax that covers the whole country, but it also allows the cantons, like our states here in the United States, to have their own level of taxation. And many of the cantons in Switzerland have basically reduced taxes on foreign corporations that come in to establish a factory or an office there to virtually nothing, so that these companies only have to pay the federal tax. And here comes the good news. The federal tax in Switzerland, 7.8%. And that, friends, is less than you pay on your income, way less. So corporations have been coming. Guess what? The other governments in Europe aren't pleased by this. Why? Because this is the famous race to the bottom. If the canton in Switzerland pulls away a company in your country by offering lower taxes, you can bet your bottom dollar that there will be politicians in your country who say that the way to cope with this is to make the tax in our country even lower than what they have in Switzerland to keep our companies here, which they do. And that, of course, stimulates the canton in Switzerland to lower it again. And so we have a kind of leapfrogging in which every political authority tries to outdo the other one by bringing corporations in at ever lower taxes. Of course, the corporations love this. This is a bidding war for them, whose end result is lower taxes on business for all multinational corporations as they decide where to locate and where to relocate. The Europeans, under pressure from the mass of their people, don't like this. What do I mean, the mass of people? Well, figure it out with me. If, over time, competition among political authorities, states, whole governments, one against the other, lowers the taxes, then the amount of money coming in to the governments, step by step, is being reduced. What do those governments do as their revenue from taxing corporations is driven down by this absurd competition among political authorities? Well, they do one of two things, or both. They raise taxes on individuals to make up for what they're not getting from corporations, or they cut public services because they can't afford them anymore since they can't tax corporations. So the mass of people suffer either rising personal taxes or lower government services or both. And the European, because they have massive trade unions that are not in such terrible decline as here, they have powerful socialist, communist, green, and other left-wing parties, they can make their pressure felt. So the Europeans said to the Swiss, you can't do this anymore. And if you continue, we will begin to discriminate against you. And you don't want that, because Switzerland is a small, landlocked country in Europe and depends on its relationships with the rest of Europe to an enormous extent. So what did the Swiss do? Being good capitalists, as they have so long been, they decided, okay, we are going to require that foreign companies coming into Switzerland pay the same taxes as our domestic companies. In other words, we won't allow this bidding to bring them in by undoing what every other part of Europe is trying to do with taxing corporations. But to soften the blow, the Swiss government said, the blow on these multinationals who are going to have to pay the same tax everybody else does in Switzerland, who's a business, they're going to lower their business taxes on everybody, domestic
as well as foreign. So as the foreign have to adjust to the domestic is being brought down, so it's not so difficult for them. That was the plan of the Swiss government. That was the federal decision. But under Swiss law, now here's where it becomes relevant to America. Under Swiss law, if 50,000 Swiss citizens sign a petition that they don't like a law, that they don't want something, it has to go to a referendum where all Swiss people can vote on it. And that's what happened. More than 50,000 signed it real fast, and it was put to a referendum, and that was held last week. Do the Swiss people want to see taxes on all business come down as the way to soften the blow for those multinationals who no longer get away with murder by not paying proper taxes? 59% of the people of Switzerland said, no way is this going to happen. So the plan is dead. And who mobilized for this? The trade unions, the left-wing political parties, the consumer groups, just exactly who you would guess. And they made the argument crystal clear. To lower taxes for all businesses, domestic and foreign, to make life easier for the foreign, means that the Swiss government will have less money than before, and therefore will either tax us as individuals more to make up the money or cut the public services to Swiss citizens, and we, the Swiss citizens, will not accept it. So it's dead. Why am I telling you this? Because the Swiss showed that a population given a chance to vote on what goes on can actually figure it out really quite well and act accordingly? No, that's only half of it. The reason I'm telling you the story is it's the same here. Mr. Trump, for example, proposes to tax corporations that bring goods in from Mexico and China in order to persuade them, to pressure them, to relocate their productions so that they don't have factories in Mexico and China, etc., but bring them back to the United States. And he threatens to tax them if they don't. Well, they yell and scream. So Mr. Trump came up with a solution. He already did this in the campaign, and now he's moving on it as president. He's going to lower taxes on all corporations in America. He's actually proposed to reduce it from the current level, statutory level of 35% to 15%. No small potatoes here. And that would cut the amount of revenue that the United States government gets from corporate taxes by a very large sum. In other words, to coax corporations to bring production back here, which they may or may not do, what is going to happen in any case is a massive reduction of corporate income tax, corporate profits tax, which the Republicans in the Congress have already signed off on. They want that too, because those are the people who fund the Republican Party. So we're doing exactly what Switzerland has done, with this difference. There is no procedure for people to sign a petition. There is no procedure for the petition to force a referendum where the American people could choose whether they like this or not. We don't have that. The Swiss had it and used it. We don't have it, so we can't use it. And that's what we're going to see unless a massive social movement blocks it. Cut government tax on corporation is coming, and that will either force us as individuals to pay more or to see more reductions in federal support for the public services we rely on. The Swiss are teaching us a lesson. The only question is, will we learn? Let me turn to another update. This one is more fun, so I'm going to enjoy it with you. I want to introduce you, if you don't already know him, to Stephen Schwartzman. Stephen Schwartzman is a very important man. He is a billionaire. That already puts him in a very special group. He is a billionaire friend of Donald Trump. That's an even more special group. And he has been named by Donald Trump to be the chair of something called the Strategic and Policy Forum, which is going to be advising Mr. Trump. So this is a very important billionaire. He is also very famous for being head of the Blackstone Group, one of the most important financial powerhouses in New York and Washington, D.C. But I'm not talking about him because he's an important man in the Trump administration, although he is. I'm talking about what came across the wire this last week, something I don't want you to miss. And that is Mr. Schwartzman turned 70 years of age last week, and he had a party. And I want to tell you about his party, because his birthday parties are famous. His 60th, 10 years ago, was famous, and his 70th, he had tried, clearly, to make it more famous. 10 years ago, before the capitalist system crashed in 2008, his elaborate party was public. It took place in the Armory in New York City, an immense building used for what the word armory implies. It was serenaded by Patti LaBelle and Rod Stewart. The cavernous Park Avenue Armory was decorated in spectacular form. This year, things were a bit quieter. The party took place in his gated home in South Florida, in an area that has come to be called the American Riviera. So here we go. I want you to understand how the other people, the other side, lives. Those people whose hearts are bleeding for the American middle class, who want to do something for the working man and woman, when they're not busy helping you, here is what they are doing. I'm now going to describe the beach house in Florida for the 70th birthday last week. The singer was Gwen Stefani. Between her sets, there were trapeze acts that included Olympic athletes. There were camels, two of them, in the sand, a gondolier on the pool, and a giant birthday cake in the shape of a Chinese temple. I'm describing the report from Bloomberg News, so the source here is impeccable. Everyone sang happy birthday at midnight. It was a memorable affair. The production was overseen by Schwartzman's wife, Christine Hurst Schwartzman. I assume you all know who Hurst and the family is. The event was designed by the famous firm Van Wyck and Van Wyck, whose clients have included Madonna, Calvin Klein, and David Koch of the Koch brothers for his 70th birthday. They share designers. Isn't it charming? Representing Donald Trump at the party were his daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner. Also present were incoming cabinet members Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, and Elaine Chao. The CEO of Barclays Bank, Jess Staley. The CEO of Citigroup, Michael Corbat. Investment titans Henry Kravis, David Rubenstein. I'm going to stop. All the rich, all the powerful, all the connected were there. But nothing summarizes the distance between them and us as the comments that were made by another attendant at the party, Richard Levin, the former president of Yale University. And here is what he said, and I'm sure it had no connection with the fact that Mr. Schwartzman has given huge amounts of money to Yale University when Mr. Levin was there. I'm sure that's not connected. Here's what Mr. Levin said, quote, "The party was a warm and wonderful reflection of Steve's generous support. His friends take pleasure in the good work that he is doing for children, institutions, and global harmony." Wow. Wow. One other person had a comment. Quote, the world is an uncertain place, comma. A lot of people are unhappy with a lot of other people. There are a lot of things that people are upset about, said a leading billionaire investor. And here it comes, folks. Quote, so it's nice to have an evening where everybody's happy, harmonious, and upbeat. The billionaires amongst us are happy, harmonious, and upbeat. Maybe the fact that you aren't has something to do with the fact that as when it comes to billionaires, you aren't either. One of the people that has entered the cabinet of Mr. Trump is Betsy DeVos. She is a champion of private education, particularly Christian education, to which she has devoted many years of her life and many millions of her billionaire family's money. And so I was struck that we're about to hand over the oversight of our education, public education system, to a person who doesn't believe in public education and wants instead to move to private education. And nothing would be better than to see how the research done by educators does or does not support what Mr. Trump decided to do with education by nominating Betsy DeVos. I've mentioned this before, but I'm going to go into a bit more detail now because she has taken this position and has this power. So I want to tell you about a book that was recently written by two specialists in this field. The names are Christopher and Sarah Lubienski, Lubienski. They are both professors of education at the University of Illinois in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. The title of their book is called, quote, The Public School Advantage, semicolon, Why Public Schools Outperform Private Schools. Yes, you heard it right. This recent book just out, by leading advocates of studying education, to which they have devoted their lives as professors of education at a leading university in the United States, they focused on math education. And they focused on an enormous research that surveyed what is going on in 13,000 public, private, and charter schools across the United States. And they used information gathered from nationwide standardized tests administered by the National Assessment of Educational Progress, NAEP. In other words, they are the specialists. What did they find? Well, the title of their book already tells you. But there's more to it than simply discovering that when it comes to math education, and by extension, they believe this applies to education in general, public schools do better for their students than private schools and charter schools. To be careful in their research, they took account of the fact that it's a different demographic. One kind of kid tends to go to a public school, whereas different kinds of kids tend to go to charter and private schools. So they only were very careful to compare students who were similar in the two schools, to compare groups of students who came from families with roughly the same income, who came from families with roughly the same ethnic breakdown, etc., etc. Even adjusting for all of that. So they were really comparing similar young people from similar families. When they went to public school, they did better than when they went to private and charter schools. There it is, friends. Betsy DeVos, nominated and now gotten the job from the Congress, from the Senate that supported her, is committed to building expanding private charter schools who do less well for students than the public schools. I could spend a lot of time talking about that, but I'm not gonna. I'd rather explore, as do the professors Lubienski, why this might be. How do you explain this? They are good professors, good researchers. When they've done their statistical examination, which takes up much of the book, they don't hesitate to offer the best they can by way of explaining the results that their research uncovered. And their explanation goes like this. Public schools do not have to compete with one another for students. Public schools are organized by neighborhood. If you live in such and such a place, your children go to that public school that services that neighborhood. If you are a private school, you are competing to pull students away from the public school and away from other private schools, and ditto for charter schools. And that means that these schools are looking to win over the parents, and so they pander to whatever is in the minds of the parents about what it is it's going to teach young people, their children, in a way that will get them into college, get them good jobs, and all the rest. They're shaped not by the universe of what's effective teaching, but whatever is in the culture right now about the right school to go to. The one with more computers than the other one. The one with, you figure it out. The competition among private schools means they don't pay attention to any of the latest research about teaching, because it's not what sells parents to bring their kids in. And that for them, that autonomy, that freedom of the private school to do whatever it wants to get parents to come in and pay rather than be subjected to the research that's coming down that all public schools are learning and following because they must, this for them is the core reason why it happens. And as an economist, I find it so interesting. A public system does better than a private, competitive, capitalist system in providing education. And therein lies a lesson that not only shows why Trump and DeVos are the wrong people in the wrong time going in the wrong direction, but it tells something about capitalism and competition as well. We've come to the end of the first half of Economic Update for today. Please stay with me after a short interlude. We will be right back with the second half and with an interview about things going on in American life today and in the economy that I think you will find very, very interesting. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Don't leave me. You said you'd love me forever. Honey, believe me, I'll have your heart on a platter. Might you recall, we've got a small family business, and the family won't like this. The bust your kneecaps. There's still time. Together I know we'd go so far. I'll tell Uncle Rocco to call off the guys with the crowbars.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update. Today I'm welcoming to the microphones a friend who's been on this program before. His name is Bob Henley. So before I introduce you, welcome, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Bob is an award-winning print and broadcast journalist. He is a staff reporter for the Chief Leader, which has been covering the civil service and public unions since 1897. His work frequently appears in Salon, Alternet, and Who, What, Why. He is also a national political affairs reporter for WBGO, the NPR jazz station in Newark, New Jersey. But he has another qualification, which is why I bring him on the program the way I do. He is one of a vanishing breed. He's an investigative journalist or reporter, the kind of person who used to be famous in our culture for tracking down the hard-to-nail-down stories, for going behind the scenes, for asking the difficult questions. People who were romantically portrayed in a whole series of movies as the ones who figured out what we all needed to know when most folks didn't do it. So he's still doing that in a profession that has really less and less space for it, and we're going to come back. So with that introduction,
thanks very much. Very generous.
Okay, we're going to start because all good investigative reporters have delicious gossip.
Right.
So I thought that before we get into the serious stuff, get to the semi-serious stuff, you have two stories that you've told me that I want you to tell our audience. One is about Sean Spicer,
right,
the person who is now the press secretary for President Trump, but is actually more famous in the impersonation on Saturday Night Live of his behavior. And the second one is a man whose name will vanish as quickly from the public awareness as it arrived, Andrew Puzder, who was going to be the labor secretary, but who withdrew his nomination from consideration this last week. So let's start. Tell us your story about Sean Spicer.
Before Sean Spicer was a national treasure, he was my personal nemesis. I guess back in 2015, I was working for CBS Money Watch, not far from here at West 57th Street. It was a good job. Got to write about the global economy, $45 an hour, of course, no benefits. Uh-huh. It was for a subcontractor called Zero Chaos. Always like that, to walk past the soundstage of the CBS Evening News, knowing that so many of the people were just temporary people working for Zero Chaos. Well, I said to my colleagues there, my editor, as we were in the throes of the campaign, the primary campaign, noticing how Donald Trump and Dr. Carson had really excited a kind of base that was really something that the Republican National Committee had a hard time controlling. And it would appear that the franchise was in trouble. They had tens of millions of dollars on deposit. Meanwhile, these black dark pool money groups had hundreds of millions of dollars available, and it seemed that as a going enterprise, the Republican Party and the RNC was kind of losing control of the brand. So we wrote the piece, put it up online, things seemed to be fine. Got a call at home, and I was told by my editor in Washington, which is where all decisions are made, I guess, about politics from CBS, is very upset. You need to try to call Sean Spicer and fix it.
So, why Sean Spicer?
Well, because he was the Republican National Committee press secretary at the time.
I see.
And so I, of course, being a team player, called him up and was hit with a shower of epithets and obscenities and my lack of qualifications to be a reporter. And I found myself picking up my own volume, and there's no productive benefit if you continue to get a few yells at someone. So I said, Mr. Spicer, let's adjourn this conversation, and let's try to get ourselves calmed down. So I did that, hung up, called him back a few minutes later. He said, I'm done with you. I'm going to be coming for you through CBS Corporate. And then he hung up. Well, needless to say, a couple of hours later, my post was taken down, no retraction, just disappeared. It's also important to know that CBS, like the other networks, very much wanted to be on the right side of the dancing Republicans for those debates that were so lucrative. And, of course, within a couple of months, while I wasn't at CBS, and I'm now at the Chief Leader.
Okay.
So that's just one instance of where you can see, as Les Moonves had said at one point at a public meeting, Donald Trump may be terrible for America, but he's great for the stockholders. So I felt a little bit of that early on.
All right. Give us your little bit story about Andrew Puzder.
Sure. Right. He was, you know, I was working on a story hoping that his nomination would endure at least towards the end of the week. I know it wasn't in the interest of the public, but we do have our own narrow self-interest. So we're working up a story on the effort to try to save this nomination, which had some serious impediments. I mean, there was the undocumented housekeeper. Well, that's kind of, in this crowd, not really something that would hold him back. Then, of course, the domestic violence, that seemed to get traction with the circulation of the Oprah tape of his ex-wife anonymously describing back in the 1990s how he really beat her up quite brutally. And in the process, I was hearing from sources in Washington that all of a sudden these apparent grassroots TV ads were showing up with members of the fast food chains Carl Jr.'s and Hardee's giving testimonials to Mr. Puzder. Now, you may know that
Testimonials that were positive, right.
So it looked like this, you know, great grassroots swell of support for him, despite the fact that he had, you know, significant labor wage violations that we were well reported on. So I started looking up these groups that were at the end of these ads and, you know, these anonymous Employment Policy Institute type sounding names. And it turned out to be supported by the very industries that were promoting the policies that, you know, Mr. Puzder was going to make his tenure very much about. And so we really are seeing now a kind of proliferation. We'll see it now with Judge Gorsuch now, where all of a sudden in major media markets, there's an ad campaign appearing to be by individuals disinterested, a groundswell of the proletariat wanting to see this man elevated. We saw the same thing with Betsy DeVos with better results than Mr. Puzder.
Right. Okay. Yes, it's a wonderful spectacle of how these things work. All right. Let me turn to some of the things that you've recently reported on that I think our radio and TV audience would like to hear. Because of Mr. Trump's initiatives in blaming immigrants for a great deal of the difficulties that the United States economy has, and not hesitating to say that a solution to at least some of those difficulties would be found in expelling immigrants, and noting, to be fair, that the Obama administration itself was a major deporter of immigrants, I have been struck by the effort of those who support this, not only to suggest that our economic problems have something uniquely to do with immigration, but to see in deporting large numbers of people a solution. This strikes me as an economist as a classic effort to distract people caught up in an economic system that isn't working to blame a scapegoat, to blame somebody else, someone else you can be angry at and take out your upset about, even though it has very little to do. And then I noticed that the biggest rationale for doing this is not the economic argument, because in fact, it's a difficult argument to make.
Right.
So it has become the crime argument that somehow, and you could notice in Mr. Trump's campaign and so forth, this notion that immigrants are criminals or disproportionately criminal or impose on us as native citizens a criminal element we wouldn't otherwise have. You've done some reporting. Tell us about
it. One of the things is that I was on the campaign trail and in Cleveland during the Republican convention. So I did see firsthand the very effective testimonials of real live people whose loved ones were killed by individuals who were chronic offenders who were undocumented and in this country illegally.
Right.
There are such dozens of cases, and Mr. Trump did a very compelling job to give these families that are still very much in pain an opportunity and a platform. I wouldn't deny their pain. But there's a deeper reality, and, you know, you can only tell these stories, not in the aggregate, but let's get particular. I've been covering the city of New York for 30 years now, okay, I'm 61. When I first started working as a beat reporter in 1990, there were 2,262 homicides. It's a big number to imagine.
In one year.
Right. The last year, 330 people were killed. That's stunning. To get a sense of what that means, 2,000 people, imagine 2,000 pairs of shoes. Those are individuals that did not get killed. This is a reduction dramatically of homicides. What was happening during that period of time? Over 500,000 undocumented immigrants came into parts of New York City that in the 1970s had been laid low by all the exploitative things you talk about capitalism, right. Neighborhoods hollowed out, found value, stabilized neighborhoods, and transformed them. Now, the big challenge is it's become such a successful city, global capital flying out of places like China is now flooding into New York, displacing those very same homesteaders that turned these communities around. This is a city of immigrants. It's a city of immigrants that has thrived and prospered on an historic level because of those immigrants.
Right. So you're basically telling us that not only did the immigrant wave coming into New York not cause or worsen crime, it's extremely the opposite. The reality is, when you look at the numbers, which right. is in the end what we have to look at, right. because otherwise you get lost in the specifics of each horrible situation. Right. When you look at the numbers, immigration, and you've given the clue to it, is a way to reduce the problem of crime, because the immigrants have no money, go into the neighborhoods that are the worst,
right.
quote, neighborhoods, and bring life and people and community into places that had none of those things.
And family.
And family into it.
And religious values.
Yes.
Irrespective,
and
I may not be
setting up their storefront exactly. churches.
So, and what's happened is a consequence also, we've seen it even, I mean, peace is breaking out all over. It's a good news story. We have a situation where at the Bloomberg, end of the Bloomberg administration, we got up to around 700,000 stop and frisks. This was a policy started under Ray Kelly. The idea was stop and frisk primarily individuals of color, less than 10% were ever arrested or even got a citation. We've dropped that number, Richard, to 22,000 a year, and the crime continues to go down. Immigration is a nation builder, not a destroyer. That's my experience. That's what I've seen.
Wow. I mean, it's something really it's hard for me to digest. The stop and frisk, just to remind everyone, was a major political issue. It's part of what Mayor de Blasio used to become the mayor of right. New York, his opposition to it, a program deeply resented by the African-American and Hispanic communities right. here in New York.
Also terribly expensive. Over the period of time of Michael Bloomberg's tenure, the city paid out $1 billion to settle tort claims for individuals whose civil rights were violated or where a stop-and-frisk incident caused the police to overreact. So it was also very expensive from the standpoint of taxpayer accountability.
Right. And it didn't work, as you see.
Right, exactly.
It didn't work. It's amazing, that kind of thing. Okay. You told me an interesting story about immigrants, this time not about crime, but about immigrants and a response by the New York firefighters.
Right. And the construction trades.
And the construction trades. Tell us about that.
Well, there's no doubt that we know historically the construction trades were very slow to integrate. There was a lot of blood spilled in this country by the white supremacist movement, very resistant to bringing in what we know to be a real pathway to a middle class and upper middle class lifestyle. To a large degree, construction trades has taken the place of manufacturing in the United mm-hmm. States, because it's something you can do with your hands and it's a trade. What I've noticed in the last few years in New York City is that the building trade started to come to understand that the undocumented immigrants that are in the city that are trying to work in this profession are not their enemies. They're their potential allies. So we see them taking a leaf out of the page of Andy Stern with Justice for Janitors in California, where the SEIU, Service of Employees International Union, had this breakthrough moment where instead of looking at the janitors that were undocumented and Latino as their enemy, they said, hey, this is the future, and brought about a kind of organization that made the SEIU one of the few unions that really grew dramatically. And as a consequence, I think President Obama got in the White House as a consequence, but the SEIU was critical to his victory. What has happened here in New York City is with the increasing boom, I've talked about construction boom, we've had an increase in fatalities primarily of undocumented individuals. We've had 30 men that have been killed in the last 2 years, hundreds in the last 10 years working at these non-union sites where they don't have the same standards in terms of safety nor training. In fact, here in Manhattan, an individual was crushed because he didn't understand English, and he was digging a hole, and he got so deep that the wall came in and suffocated him. Here, the district attorney prosecuted that case and got a conviction of the company, which was a break
of
negligence.
Right.
So what's happened now is the construction trades, about 100,000 building trades, carpenters, plumbers, and the rest, 25,000 marched on City Hall to push for a training program, a mandatory training program that would require anybody working in construction, union or non-union, to get the basic skills required to keep themselves safe, their colleagues safe, and the public safe. And what do we see on the stage at that rally? But the Uniform Fire Officers Association, the Uniform Fire Officers Association, and the ranking, the brass, okay, and supported by the TWU transit workers, all supporting the notion not of deporting undocumented people, but of training them. That's a transformational moment. You know, that is, there's probably many Trump voters within those group of people that were there. But for them, it's almost as one of the individuals said to me, no man should die because he wants to feed his family. There's a breakthrough happening here that's very good news for progressive politics.
Yeah. Strikes me also as a very hopeful sign that people will see through the scapegoating of immigrants for what it is and realize that if the people at the top had any interest in dealing decently with masses of people, they wouldn't be setting the workers they underpay against
right.
the immigrants, whom they underpay even more, but they would be coming up with plans like the firefighters, like the construction workers, to properly integrate, especially in the history of a country that literally is composed of an endless wave of immigrants.
Right. And the thing, too, here is that, what you know, when I asked one of the fire officers, well, why are you here? Is this really your fight? Because, you know, unions kind of generally run in their own lane. And he's like, you just have to respond to one of these construction sites and pull out a mangled body and know you have to deliver this body to the victims' families. So these are, and there were Catholic priests at this event. So this is really something very much in line with Pope Francis, the idea of the dignity of work, that unions really have to stand up for the universality of that very basic human right.
Yeah, and speaking of the unions, let me pull you onto a topic that we didn't prepare for, but that'll be fun.
But,
you know, the unions would be viewed differently in this country if they did that, if they weren't narrowly focused on the bread and butter issues for their members, important as those are, but were also part of a social movement that people could identify with who were not in that particular trade or not in that particular industry. And this, in a way, is what these folks are doing. They're
right.
saying to the larger immigrant community and the larger community as a whole, there's a different way of reacting to immigrants, not by
right.
deporting them,
right.
which is what our government is doing, but by a radical different way of coping. Well, now let me ask you a question. This last week, there was an election at the Boeing Corporation in South Carolina. Boeing has moved production from the state of Washington, where it was concentrated, to South Carolina to get away from the unions that are strong in
right.
Washington State and are very weak.
Right.
South Carolina has the lowest percentage of unionized workers in the United States. So Boeing went there. The machinists union tried to organize. They had a vote this last week, and the machinists union was defeated badly. And one of the reasons given was a culture in the broader population that is hostile to unions, doesn't see the benefits
right.
of unions. Well, in a way, the unions themselves, by not doing more to be in the vanguard of
right.
productive and positive change, the way the construction and firefighters were that you've just told
sure,
us
right.
about, if they were more doing that more often, might they not change the larger environment and be able to win
well,
more?
There's, I mean, even, and, you know, there's a tale of, it's of course, complicated. In the case of the firefighters, I'm still doing stories for the chief about racism within the ranks when it comes to the firehouse itself. So I don't want to, you know, the city settled a $100 million lawsuit brought by the Vulcan Firefighters Associates, the African-American fraternal organization, because of historic and systemic and widespread discrimination. But to your broader point, a part of the problem here is that I think that when you see unions and you have individuals getting these huge salaries and you have the legacy of the corruption surrounding the Teamsters, these things have become a kind of part of the mythopoetic of the culture. So people have to see something very different in their direct experience. And one of the things that unions need to do is be about full youth employment. One of the problems here is that, you know, one of the big insecurities that everyone has who's middle-aged, whether it be about their children or their grandchildren, is will they find meaningful work? Will they find a way to sustain themselves and their family? This is what we all hope for as parents. And I would submit to you that Donald Trump's success in winning the presidency was by flipping 200 counties that weren't racist. They voted for President Obama twice. We talked about these counties before the election, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio. These are places where there's a real doubt in part of these union households about whether or not their kids and their grandkids will find a place in America to support themselves. And that makes them open to the attacks from the right, the xenophobic notion that somehow it's not about reaching within, but pushing those who are different. And so what I really think we need to see is unions around the country pushing at the municipal level for full youth employment, because we have a problem here in this country. We have millions of young people who are not getting that first work experience. We know in New York City here, we've talked about this, maybe 125,000, 130,000, 16 to 23-year-olds not in school, not working. This is the failure of capitalism, where capital has failed its basic test in terms of social utility. It's not providing a pathway for young people to be able to get the basic skills that are required to work. And that's something that unions really have to be about.
You think it could change the position of unions in the United States if they took a kind of leadership position on that question?
Well, to me, it is where Dr. King would be today. It is the new civil rights movement, because we have a situation now where automation is being introduced. You know, you can bring back manufacturing to the United States, but in point of fact, chances are robots will be doing it. So we have to really have a conversation about the importance and social utility of work for more than just generating capital, for giving life definition and meaning
to people.
Right.
And so if the unions, I want to push you, if the unions did
identify themselves with it, I think
it could change how they are viewed and their social position.
Right. Not looking like they're just about their own sinecure. And one of the things that they have to be really careful about is Donald Trump has this playbook where he's playing off the building trades. That's the blue collar workforce off of the public unions. This is a playbook that Chris Christie tried to use with some effect. And you'll see it where he had the construction trades in to sign after the Trans-Pacific pipeline, because that's always been a difficult fault line for a progressive movement, because guys who do men and women who lay pipe and do that kind of work, they want the work, and they may not be so concerned about down the line the implications of global warming. So labor has to resolve those conversations, those frictions that can be exploited from without by capital.
Right. I wonder whether you noticed that this last week, Pope Francis, whom you mentioned, had a conference in the Vatican devoted to indigenous people and said unmistakably that respect for the water, respect for the sacred burial grounds of indigenous people has to be respected. Unmistakable. Letting everybody know on which side of the Dakota pipeline he stands.
Well, he just has to get rid of the doctrine of Christian discovery. That would be a good thing. Just reverse that. That'd be good.
Okay. You've done some work on housing. And so we come to the end of our time together, I wanted you to share with our audience who's interested in the economics of housing, but in housing as a phenomena, what your research as an investigative reporter has told you about the housing crisis. Let me put it to you this way. If you were advising the doctor who has become the head of housing for Mr. Trump, who has, as far as I know, no experience or background in anything having to do with housing other than the fact that he lived in it, what would you advise him?
Well, I first want to say there was one moment in monitoring the hearings where I saw him win. And it had to do with when he was asked about what his experience is. And, of course, he did come up through public housing. He did experience housing insecurity, as the professionals say. But he described the frustration as an accomplished physician in treating young people at Johns Hopkins and returning them to substandard conditions. Right. So that was at least some authentic moment where people knew that was true, and compared to the rest of the Trump circus, that they were give him a shot. Well, first, I would advise that they immediately suspend foreclosure proceedings and that the federal government or empower local states and municipalities the power to condemn all zombie homes, to immediately, forthwith, take control of zombie homes and then create... homes are homes, and there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of them across the country that are caught up where the banks were... forced people out of them, but then the banks wouldn't declare the loss because if they actually took possession of it, they'd have to experience the depreciation in value that their manipulation of the market secured. Very nice, right?
Yes.
So in Cleveland, we had 6,000 zombie homes during the convention, little attention spent to it. 40,000 vacant lots and zombie homes in Philadelphia. So you want to fix American housing and get kids back to work? Immediately empower municipalities to take possession of all homes that no one's lived in for at least a year. Then create a work progress administration along the line of Habitat for Humanity, where you empower young people in construction trades to begin rebuilding those homes and provide them to the people that are now paying higher and higher amounts of their disposable income to rent and to those people that are homeless.
In other words,
it can be done in a couple of months.
A public program not subordinated to private profit could solve employment problems, housing problems, deterioration of property value all at the same time.
Right.
Well, if you needed a critique of private capitalism, there it is. Bob Hennelly, thank you very, very much for being with us. This is why investigative reporting is important. People have the time, the energy, and the interest to get good work done.
Can I get my
that
Twitter
teaches
handle?
Us. Please.
I'm at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. Bob Hennelly at Stuck Nation.
There we go. and you can follow Bob's work that way, and he'll be on this program again. Thank you again, Bob.
My pleasure.
Before we sign off, folks, let me remind you, we have two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info, where you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, be a partner with us. We want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis that has been a partner with us for a long time. Make use of these websites, friends. They're free, they're available 24/7, and they're a way for you to extend the reach of the kind of work we do here. Thanks again for listening and watching, and I look forward to being with you again next week.
My time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change. Thing gonna change. Yes, it is.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Fascism, the False Revolution. A talk given by the political analyst and author Michael Parenti in 1995 sounds almost as if it was given in 2017 in the context of European and U.S. elections. In his 50-plus years of lecturing at major universities, Parenti returned many times to the important connection between capitalism and fascism. actually over 32,000 times, if you believe the search engines. Fascism, as Mussolini said, should be more properly called corporatism, since it is the merger of state and corporate power, end quote. And history, as told by Michael Parenti, shows that in all fascist societies, be it Italy, Germany, Japan, Spain, and into the present, corporate power increased. And that gain in power, such as tax cuts, deregulation, subsidies for extraction of oil and minerals, involves a loss of power, rights, environmental and workplace protection, and wages for those who work for a living. Parenti, who grew up in an Italian-American working-class family in New York City and earned his PhD in political science from Yale, was familiar with Benito Mussolini from childhood on. Some members of his working-class family admired Mussolini. Others were ready to fight fascism in World War II. Parenti wasn't even a teen when war was begun. 5.5 decades later, he begins this lecture about the false revolution of fascism with a brief history of the origins of fascism in Italy and Germany. Michael Parenti.
I want to look at some of the neglected attributes of fascism and its relevance for what's happening today. Before World War I, Benito Mussolini was a socialist. But many of his socialist comrades thought he was less interested in advancing the cause of socialism than in advancing himself. And sure enough, the minute that the wealthy classes in Italy offered him financial support and the promise of power, he didn't hesitate to switch sides. We know about people who switch sides, don't we? And with the huge sums he got from wealthy interests, Mussolini was able to project himself onto the national scene as the acknowledged leader of I Fasci di Combattimento, it was called, a movement composed of ex-army officers and various other toughs who were used as a kind of anti-labor militia. They specialized in attacking unions, peasant farm cooperatives, socialists, communists, and anarchists. After World War I, Italy's parliamentary government faced a post-war recession. To maintain profit levels, the large industrialists and big landowners would have to slash wages and raise prices. The state, in turn, would have to provide the big owners with massive subsidies and tax exemptions. To finance this corporate welfareism, the populace would have to be taxed more heavily, and social welfare expenditures would have to be drastically cut. Does all of this sound familiar? But the government wasn't completely free to apply these harsh measures, because many Italian workers and peasants had their own unions and fairly strong political organizations, with demonstrations, strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, the forcible occupation of farmlands, and all these things. They won some substantial concessions in wages, in work conditions, and in the right to organize. So the workers and peasants were able to mount a defense of their standard of living. To roll back that standard of living and to get the economic changes that the plutocrats and tycoons wanted, the ruling interests had to abolish the democratic rights that helped workers and peasants defend that standard. So the solution was to smash their organizations and their political liberties. In 1922, the Federazione Industriale, the leaders of industry, along with top bankers and agribusiness associations, met with Mussolini to plan the March on Rome, contributing 20 million lira to the so-called fascist revolution. Within 2 years after seizing state power, Mussolini had shut down all opposition newspapers and crushed the socialist, liberal, Catholic, Democratic, and Republican parties, which together had commanded about 80% of the vote. The fascists were never a majority in Italy. Opposition leaders, union leaders, and others were beaten, exiled, or murdered. the Italian Communist Party endured the severest repression of all. In Germany, there was a very similar pattern of complicity between fascists and capitalists. German workers and farm laborers had won the eight-hour day, unemployment insurance, the right to unionize. They had built very strong political organizations also. But heavy industry and big finance were in a state of nearly total collapse. Business wanted to cut wages. Business wanted tax cuts and massive state subsidies to revive profit levels. During the 1920s, the Nazi stormtroopers were subsidized by business and were used to terrorize workers and farm laborers. But by 1930, a decision was made by the German tycoons, and that decision was that the Weimar Republic no longer served their needs and was too accommodating to the working class and to the Social Democrats. They greatly increased their subsidies to Hitler, and propelling the Nazi Party onto the national stage. In fact, Hitler himself boasted of it, the immense amount of campaign material we got. 1,000 automobiles with loudspeakers. Each of them could make 100 appearances. So 100,000 appearances saturating every town and village in the cities of Germany, getting out this propaganda, money to build their party organization, their youth groups, and their paramilitary forces. You can read book after book about fascism and Nazism and find almost nothing said about the economic policies of these regimes, of the things I just told you about now. They're just not in the books. There's also a vast literature on who supported the Nazis. Who supported them? Well, there were some rich tycoons, but some of them were against them. And some workers voted for them and some against them. It's hard to say, blah, 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 stuff. Very little is ever written about who the Nazis supported when they came in, who the fascists supported when they came in. Because that would be much more revealing, you see. And this is in keeping with the tendency of mainstream scholarship to avoid the entire subject of capitalism whenever something unfavorable might be said about it. Well, who did Mussolini and Hitler support once they seized state power? In both countries, a strikingly similar agenda was pursued. Labor unions and strikes were outlawed. Union property and publications were confiscated. Farm cooperatives were handed over to rich private owners. Big agribusiness farming was heavily subsidized. In Italy, child labor was reintroduced. In both Germany and Italy, the already modest wages of the workers were cut drastically. In Germany, from 25 to 40% cuts. In Italy, 50% wages cut. These were already rather modest wages as it was. In both countries, minimum wage laws, overtime pay, and factory safety regulations were abolished or turned into dead letters. Taxes were increased for the general populace, but lowered or eliminated for the rich and big business. Inheritance taxes for the wealthy were greatly reduced or abolished. Both Mussolini and Hitler showed their gratitude to their business patrons by handing over to them publicly owned and perfectly solvent steel mills, power plants, banks, steamship companies. Privatization, it's called. Privatization. Both regimes dipped heavily into the public treasury to refloat or subsidize heavy industry. Corporate welfareism, we would call it today. Both states guaranteed a return on the capital invested by giant corporations and assumed most of the risks and losses on investment. Sounds like savings and loan, if you ask me. As in all reactionary regimes, public capital was raided by private capital. The result of all of this? In Italy during the 1930s, the economy was gripped by recession, a staggering public debt, widespread corruption, but industrial profits rose, and the armaments factories busily rolled out the weapons. In Germany, unemployment was eased somewhat because there was a massive depression when they came in, and it was eased because of the massive arms program and the arms spending. But generally, poverty increased. I mean, if you cut wages 25 to 40%, poverty is increased no matter how many jobs you might create. But from 1935 to 1943, the net income of German corporate leaders rose 46%. In both countries, the conditions of labor deteriorated greatly. speed-ups, dismissals, imprisonment for workers who complained about unsafe or inhumane work conditions, longer hours for less wages. You know, looking at this years ago, I used to say that fascism never really succeeded in solving the irrational contradictions of capitalism. Today, I believe it was never intended to solve the irrational contradictions of capitalism, at least not for the populace and for the people. Now I'm of the opinion that it actually, in a way, did succeed. It succeeded in solving the problems of capitalism, but only for the capitalists. Fascism offers a reactionary solution, not a social solution, to the contradictions of capitalism. It forces all the burdens and losses onto the working public. And in those days, by the way, there was any number of U.S. bankers and industrialists, including the likes of Henry Ford, who appreciated the way fascism was serving the moneyed class, and they were avid admirers. They gave political and even financial support to Mussolini and Hitler. The U.S. press was also filled with admiration. Fortune magazine, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, you know, the free and independent press that speaks for all of us. They hailed Il Duce as the man who rescued Italy from radicalism and brought perfect harmony to the country. The image of an Italy in a state of perfect harmony is one that challenges the imagination in any case. In regard to Hitler, the U.S. press in the 1930s had a rather substantial contingent of give Adolf a chance group, you know. Let's give Adolf a chance. He means well. Oh, he may be a little rough here or there, but some of that sympathy was greased directly by Nazi money. You know, Hearst entered a deal where the Nazis, he had his wire service. The Nazis paid him something like 10 times the normal subscription, and in response, Hearst fired any reporters who filed negative stories and admonished the others to treat the Nazi Germany in a nice light. Gray Brechin told me that he found back issues of Hearst newspapers that contained guest columns by Nazi leaders like Alfred Rosenberg and Hermann Göring. So, I mean, we're talking thick here. They were thick, you know. As the war clouds gathered, as Italy, Germany, and Japan, who were the late comers in the industrial world, began to challenge the interests of the more established Western capitalist nations, then press coverage begins to get a little more critical. Now, some mainstream writers and academics and scholars, quote, not only deny fascism's close collaboration with big business, they even argue that business was one of the victims of fascism. Angelo Codevilla, a Hoover Institute right-wing flack, blithely announcing in Commentary magazine, August 94, quote, if fascism means anything, it means government ownership and control of business. And he goes on and says, so business doesn't like fascism. They often try to misrepresent fascism as a mutant form of socialism. In fact, if fascism means anything, it means government support and subsidy for business, mass privatization, and intensified exploitation and repression of labor, in a word. Fascists and Nazi leaders did not merely serve the capitalists, they also served themselves. I mean, they were unprincipled people. Mussolini lived like a king. Hitler is portrayed to us as an ascetic fanatic, a devoted ideologue who wasn't concerned with material things. Yeah, sure. In fact, Hitler accumulated an immense fortune, much of it in very shady ways. During his entire tenure in office, he avoided paying any income taxes or property taxes and got special rulings from the German tax office. The letters are very amusing. Yes, yes, we see no reason for you. You have heavy state expenditures, yes. No taxes for you, mein Führer. He expropriated artworks from the public domain. He stole enormous sums from Nazi party coffers, including endowments and donations, small ones, big ones. He took a lot of it for himself. He invented a new concept. It was called the personality right. He charged a minute fraction of a fee for every postage stamp that was sold that had his picture on it. And he made hundreds of millions of marks. The greatest source of Hitler's wealth was from a secret slush fund to which German industrialists regularly donated. Wolf Schwarzbeller, in a book about Hitler's private fortune, quote, "Hitler knew that as long as German industry was making money, his private money sources would be inexhaustible. Thus, he would see to it that German industry was never better off than under his rule, by launching, for one thing, gigantic armaments projects, or what we would call today defense contracts, right? Hitler lived self-indulgently. He had a motor pool of limousines, private apartments, country homes, a vast staff of servants, a majestic estate in the Alps. He was a snob. His happiest times were when he was entertaining European royalty, including the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, who themselves were delighted to be his guests. There are photos of them all like this, shaking hands and looking adoringly at each other. Well, come on, Parenti, is that all fascism is, a conspiracy to save capitalism? Well, that might not be all that it is, but that's quite an important part of it. So could we talk about that once in a while? It's the part that Hitler himself kept referring to when he talked about saving the industrialists and bankers from Bolshevism. Mussolini also designated himself Italy's savior from the red tide. But what was exactly so terrible about communism was not that it threatened democracy. The Italian fascists and German Nazis both openly detested democracy, and they destroyed it when they came to power in any case. The industrialists, those guys weren't worried about democracy being taken over. It was that communism and the left in general was never strong enough to take state power in either country, but they were strong enough to interfere with profit rates and the capital accumulation process, and this was threatening enough for the moneyed interests. Now, I don't want to deny fascism's ideology and its irrational appeals, but even these irrational elements had a rational class control function. You know, I've said it many times that much of politics is the rational manipulation of irrational symbols. Because you got the irrational symbols, it doesn't mean that the people who are putting them out don't know what they're doing, that they're just stupid and we are the only ones who know. In fascism, look at these so irrational appeals. There's the atavistic appeals. Go back to the mythical roots of our people. For Mussolini, it was going back to the grandeur that was Rome. For Hitler, the ancient folk. There's the cult of the leader, Il Duce, the Führer. In fact, the Nazis called it der Führerprinzip, the leader principle. With leader worship and state worship, there's the glorification of militarism, war, and conquest. But these are all basically conservative symbols, you see. These are all basically to get people distracted from their own immediate interests, political, economic, class interests, and get them galvanized into this kind of thing, the war, the conquest, the militarism. Most of the Italian army, in fact, the ordinary recruits, putting the black shirt fanatics aside, most of the Italian recruits had no taste for war whatsoever. So the fascist doctrines do stress these monistic values, oneness, ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer, one people, one state, one leader. The people are no longer to be concerned with class divisions, but they must see themselves as part of a harmonious authoritarian whole, a view that's very supported of the socioeconomic status quo. This is very much in contrast to a left agenda, which advocates a sharpened awareness of class injustice and class struggle, the articulation of popular demands, and the self-generated participation of popular forces. Fascism, especially the Nazi version, had an explicit commitment to racism, as you all know. Human attributes are said to be inherited through blood. Genetics and biology are said to justify the existing class structure, just as our academic racists today are doing with their bell curve theories and their warmed over eugenics claptrap and all that stuff they're meddling in. Fascism also supports sexual inequality and homophobia. The oppression of gays was often criminal and homicidal. The oppression of women was traditionally patriarchal. Mussolini, quote, "A man is not a man unless he is a husband, a father, and a soldier, giving orders in the first two roles and taking orders in the third." Woman's greatest calling is to tend to the needs of her husband and children, producing as many as she can for the state. Children, not husbands. This patriarchal ideology, I would maintain, is linked to a conservative class ideology. If women get out of line, what will happen to the family? If the family goes, then the entire social structure is at risk. And if the social structure unravels, what will happen to my position, my privileges, my wealth? That's still the concern today in this country. I mean, do you really think that right-wing leaders who talk about family values care about the family? Let's take three of the most outspoken proponents most recently who I've heard mouthing off about family values: Phil Gramm, Bob Dole, and Newt Gingrich. You know. Well, you know what those three... I don't want to get ad hominem, but one thing those three all have in common is they all left their wives and kids and ran off with other women. But a lot of people get divorced. More important, the other thing they have in common is they're all pursuing and advocating policies that are very harmful to the family and very harmful to children and the whole task of raising children. So they use the issue to mobilize voter sentiment and to evade economic issues. In Nazi Germany, racism, anti-Semitism were used, as you know, to rechannelize some legitimate grievances to irrelevant enemies, scapegoating, as we would call it. Many middle-class Germans, they knew they were victimized by very powerful economic forces, but they were too bound up in the conventional social order to really adopt a revolutionary course. They couldn't do that. So they went in a fascist direction. They started voting for the Nazi parties. To the extent, by the way, that the Nazis had any kind of mass base, it was among the middle and upper middle class. Some of the photos of Nazi audiences are very revealing. The people are very well dressed. This image that Hitler went among the common people is really rather questionable. It was a combination of middle class, petty bourgeois, and some lumpenpro. There was a lumpenpro, beer hall, rabble, and those people who became the stormtroopers, as a matter of fact, who did have a kind of a leftish position, as I'll talk about in a minute. Not more than one-fourth to one-third, it varied from elections, not more than one-fourth to one-third of the organized workers ever voted for the Nazi Party. The overwhelming majority voted for the Communist parties or the Social Democrats. Now, anti-Semitic propaganda was very emotive and irrational, but it was cleverly crafted to appeal to certain groups. So to workers and peasants, they were told, it's the Jewish capitalists who are doing this, the Jewish usurers. To the middle class, they were told, it's the Jewish trade union leaders and the Jewish communists who are doing this. To the super patriots, the Jew is the enemy alien and internationalist and the like. So it depended on the group, and you see the propaganda really was crafted and leaned a certain way to make very definite appeals. So the Nazis, they may have been crazy, but they weren't stupid. Again, it's what I was saying, the rational use of irrational symbols and arguments. What distinguishes fascism from ordinary right-wing autocracies, which today are also called fascism, we call just about every right-wing repressive, and I think justifiably because they fulfill the same function ultimately. But what distinguished fascism was the way it attempted to cultivate a revolutionary aura and give the impression of being a mass movement. Fascism offers a really beguiling mix of revolutionary-sounding mass appeals and reactionary class politics. You want to sum it up. The Nazi Party's full name, as you know, was the National Socialist German Workers' Party. I mean, they very consciously left-sounding, stealing the thunder of the left in various ways. The stormtroopers had a share-the-wealth mentality. And in fact, after Hitler came into power, the SA, the brown shirts, was suppressed because they were waiting to divide up some of the wealth. Both the Italian fascists and the Nazis made a conscious effort at imitating the left. Youth organizations, mass mobilizations, rallies, parades, banners, symbols, slogans, uniforms. And I think for this reason, too, many mainstream writers treat fascism and communism as totalitarian twins. People like A. James Gregor, people like William Ebenstein in that popularizing book of his, Today's Isms, which is now in its eighth edition and used in so many schools. Every time I look at it, I go, oh, God, what a book. They talk about this sort of thing. They can't tell the difference between, they literally can't tell the difference, or they pretend they can't tell the difference between fascism and communism. But most workers and peasants could tell the difference. Industrialists and bankers could tell the difference. And certainly the communists and the fascists themselves could tell the difference. I'll give you a more recent example, non-academic example of this kind of obfuscation. It's from that crypto-fascist himself, John Paul II, the CIA pope. In 1989, the pontiff pontificated, quote, "Nazi paganism and Marxist dogma are both basically totalitarian ideologies and tend to become substitute religions." So what he's doing here, what all these people are doing, is reducing essence to form. That is, taking a few similarities of form and ignoring then the enormous differences in actual political content and class commitment. Fascism, in fact, is a false revolution. It makes a revolutionary appeal without making an actual revolution. It propagates the widely proclaimed new order while serving the same old moneyed interests.
That was the first half of a one-hour lecture on fascism, The False Revolution, by Dr. Michael Parenti. In spite of the many references that apply to the present, as of 2017, this talk was given to standing room audience of 1,200 in Berkeley, California, on September 23, 1995. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale. He is the author of 23 books and many more articles. His works have been translated into at least 18 languages. Parenti consciously gave up the opportunity for an academic career. He publicly opposed the war in Vietnam, was arrested, and lost his position. Parenti decided to become an independent author, lecturer, and activist, and has taught in the U.S. and abroad. Come back for the conclusion of Fascism, the False Revolution, when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.
To Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Well, if we really do think like an ecosystem, and you think that in nature, in wider nature, of course, we are nature, everything is created by the context in which it is in and shaped. You know, a plant thrives or not depending on what situation it's in. What is the soil like? Does it have access to the sunlight, etc.? And so everything is shaped by everything around it. And that's what I mean when by saying the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world.
That's the voice of Frances Moore LePay. On this week's show, we speak to Frances about her award-winning book, Getting a Grip, right after a song by Nomadic Massive, so stay tuned.
Pas pas mon stylo, yo quand même j'en comprends yo. Poco, mais yo l'entends pour pilote yo. Salou, n'a yo pas connaît qui s'en tire à sous. Mais malouk, m'en des sacs connaît moins trop dans ma boucle. Moi j'ai grandi mal, mal, parole ou trop banal. Sous continuer pour ça, on va finir dans gros escandale. Pensez pas des mal, moi pas à vivre mal. Mais pas forcément calo, vous voyez tête en mon canal.
C'est dans les annales, style conviction et artisanal. Know the range in us, this duo got tank dangerous. So strange, it's us, two brains that rush. Paint with the brush that stain with the pain of a razor's rush. Cunning, we cunning. Border crossing, running, stunning with the hunting of words, punning, coming at ya, got you out your zone, loopy, soul food, tight like catacombs, like stepping to the mic with no skills, like ripping up a 6 month over the bill. When kids won't listen to their parents, lost in a video game with music blaring. Like spending an hour flipping channel, you're watching commercials at prices you can't handle.
Voulez être un foncier haïtien, quitte à l'étranger, coupé ou pas d'un poignet. Dangerous, it's so dangerous. If I look around, all I see is danger.
Like they trash that, wars for cash back. It's sad that my man Nars can't spend his summers in Baghdad. Why is that? Why? The reasons are clear, but the truth is never out there. It might get dangerous if you speak loud and clear. Lots of fear, got people nervous, sticking to their own. But we ain't got no home, that's why we grown. Tweez hit my rhythm, live them out with our own twist. Lemonade curry in a hurry, but there's a long list of people waiting to get something out of life. Running out of time with a gigantic appetite. Obese expectations, that's why we train our hearts. Never blindfolded if we have to throw a dart. These minds, hearts defined like untouched vinyl. Centralized, connect dots like Rue Lino. Yeah, live out this moment, pull out your tape recorder. You never know at every corner, there might be some sort of. Like George Bush's vision of the planet. Like missiles crossing the Atlantic, I see you panic. When neighbors won't greet each other, people don't know how to treat each other. They're hearing nothing. When religion means division, cutting up people with the precision of a surgeon's incision.
Dangerous, it's so dangerous. I look around, all I see is danger. J'avance dans sa cadence, non balance, pas d'avance. Pour nous prendre cap, j'ai mis galé, espoir, gagné l'influence. Si je prends micro, c'est pour me chanter, revendiquer, pour me cadoucher, ça gagne, voir, baillot, l'espoir, casser la croix, pour le grand pouvoir. Son ange pour propre vie, ou tout va croire dans tête, ou les décampés et prendre place, ou ma boue, ou pipi sans passer pour nous. Depuis nos îles, ils font libérer l'esprit en nous. Prendre des focus, pas prendre un blocus. On apprend à marcher, même si t'es stagé à cactus. En grand, pas jamais bêtisé à grand grand monde. On va faire autre chose, parce que moi, c'est un être aliment. Boroc, pas jamais. Bec croisé en game choc, qui démêlait ma voix sous son rappel qui saute New York. No lock, pas d'un gros chasse pour grader stem. Si t'en joues ta bouche, je me prends au moins tout ça.
That was the incredible Nomadic Massive, Danger, Danger. It seems for too long the media has been trying to inculcate this fear of one another, fear of your neighbor. You know, there's always something we're supposed to be afraid of. Well, someone who is not afraid of anything, her book inspires a certain confidence and courage, is Frances Moore LePay. She's a best-selling author. She's written many books. Her latest book, Getting a Grip, it's a wonderful book about resistance. It's a book that has sold now more than 3 million copies, and people really are inspired by her. So we're very privileged to have her on our show. Thank you so much for joining us, Frances.
I'm delighted, totally delighted.
Now, I was thinking about the way in which our society at times can tend to feel a bit frightful. If the only source of your news or information is the media, then, you know, you might as well put your head under the bed and don't get out because things look pretty sad. So let's begin there. Let's talk a little bit. In your book, you say, why are we as society creating a world that we as individuals abhor? And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, first of all, how we've created this monster that we seem to be afraid to live in.
Right. It kind of defies logic in a way, doesn't it, that we created something that none of us individually would ever choose. So how did that happen? And my theory, and I stress theory because I really want to be engaged with other people with differing ideas, but what I've come to is that the only thing powerful enough to cause this to happen is the power of ideas. That sounds kind of strange, but actually in our species, it turns out that our minds are more powerful than instinct, that our minds can actually override instincts. When you think of, you know, people do on the positive side, people denying themselves food and instinct in a hunger strike for an idea, some idea of justice. And on the other hand, on the negative, you read and hear the horror stories of parents killing their children in honor killings. Nothing could be more against our evolution than killing our own offspring, right? And yet an idea of honor seems to make that happen. So I'm arguing and getting a grip that actually what we have to look at are the ideas that rob us of power, that rob us of power to create the world we really want. And the core idea that you touched on as you began, you know, you talked about fear. At the base of that fear is the assumption of scarcity, of lack, that there's just not enough goods and there's not enough goodness in us.
In your book, you talk about a different kind of democracy than the one we have been inculcated with, you know, this representative democracy that doesn't seem to serve our interests. Because as Susan George points out, we elect our government, but then they give the money to the bank. So, you know, they're not really acting in our interests. But in your book, you're very lucid about the kinds of democracy. You call it a thin democracy and a participatory democracy. Can you tell us the difference?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the term I like best is living democracy, because that term living democracy, it kind of brings up for me associations of ongoing change and something that has that is an organism, like an ecological system. And so I describe what we have now as thin, or actually what I've come to is calling it a privately held government. It's not really a democracy in the sense of answering to the citizens. So representative democracy wouldn't be bad at all if we could get there, you know, electing people really accountable to us. And what I underscore toward the end of Getting a Grip is that there is a pathway there of to get money out of the system. But I contrast this notion of thin democracy or privately held government, which is something done to us or for us, a structure of government that we kind of inherited and is failing us. I contrast that with what is emerging that so gets me up in the morning, which is this idea, back again to the power of ideas, that democracy is really a culture, that you can have all the institutions in place, and if you don't have the culture of participation and the values of engaging with others in direct problem solving, then you can't solve your problems. It came to me when I first started working on the question of world hunger, and I traveled to places like, you know, the Philippines or Central America, and they had India, you know, they have elections, and they had multiple parties, but people, majority were living in misery. So those institutions don't themselves define democracy. It's the culture that we create. And right now I think we're unfortunately going away from a culture of democracy based in the values of inclusion of all of us, of mutual accountability, and the ongoing dispersion of power.
As you're talking about the kind of cultural democracy we need to create, you actually spell it out in your book, and you call it an ecology of democracy, and you actually spell out the five different particular qualities. Now, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that ecology of democracy, because I think this is essential to understanding what it is we're lacking and where it is we want to get to.
This is essential, you know, the idea of democracy as something that just sort of set in place and finished a structure, that is failing. And so I describe an ecology of democracy is not a set system, but a set of system qualities. And, for example, one of these five is simply the notion, the quality that it is ever-changing and evolving, that it's not fixed. I argue that the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world, because, in fact, we're changing the world moment to moment for the good or the bad, even if we don't act, you know, that we're still having an effect. Another argument that I make is that living democracy is an aspect of these values that I mentioned of inclusion and fairness and mutual accountability. They're equally valid in economic life, in education, for example. We see great progress where students are empowered to be part of decision-making. That these values aren't strictly political sphere values, that in a living democracy, you know, that they really work. As I say, they're not strictly political values. So those are the kinds of things that I pull out in this book.
One of the most important things you mention in your book is that democracy is not something we're born with, that we're not learned or that is automatic, you know, something that we sort of pass on genetically, but rather that is something we culture, we nurture, we teach, and we foster as a relationship. And the opposite of that is what you represent in your book, and you point out, you even have a draft for it that you call the spiral of powerlessness. So I want to spend a little time talking a little bit about how sometimes we disempower ourselves and the different steps that take us there, and then the opposite of that, which you also offer. So let's talk a little bit about when we're lacking this element of dynamism in democracy, of participation, of values, of you know, how do we create this spiral of powerlessness that you describe in your book?
I'm so glad you touched on this. It's actually sort of the third quality of living democracy, that it is a learned art, you know, just like we learn to play the piano or to write. You know, we can learn the arts of democracy using power creatively, using conflict creatively, mentoring others, negotiating difference, mediating, all of these things that young people are learning in certain contexts. I have a little chapter, you know, on rethinking power, because a lot of people, power is a dirty word. You know, you think that anybody who has power, it has to mean control and manipulation, when actually power just means our capacity to act. And that capacity to act starts with a sense of possibility. And that, to me, is rooted in this ecological way of seeing, in which we think like an ecosystem and see that change is the nature of life. And if that's true, then, as my friend in Germany, the physicist Hans-Peter Dürer says, in ecology, in fact, in biological systems, in the world as a whole, there are no parts. There are only participants. So that then we see the power that we have, that moment to moment we are affecting our environment, and then that opens us to a sense of possibility. And so I describe myself not as an optimist, because I can't see the future, but as a possibilist, because I know that the nature of life is change. And one of the things that most excites me is learning the new neuroscience findings that actually there are neurons in our brains that fire when we observe other people as if we were doing that act. So imagine the power that gives us, one, to learn, and two, to affect others, because as people are listening to you, you are actually, you know, in your setting up in their minds images and telling stories, there is actually part of their brain functioning as if they were engaged in that activity. So I think that this interconnected world that ecology teaches us, this is a huge breakthrough from the world of stasis and, you know, the power understood as either you have it or you don't, you know, a zero sum. If you have it, that means I don't, to power in a living democracy, meaning what we create together. And I think that is another core characteristic of a living democracy. We understand that we have to join with others to create power together to solve problems.
I love the way you organize your book, and so you know, you take us through through this step of, you know, how do you create powerlessness by our own, you know, defeating narratives, right? And then you
right.
describe the relationship of power, this, you know, ubiquitous power that develops as people act, you know, and interact with one another. But also you talk about the art of democracy. You talk about the cycle of hope, and you really exemplify the way in which we as citizens are agents of our own actions. One of the key questions that we face today is that of economic inequality. We look mm-hmm. worldwide and we see that 2/3 of the world population are living below poverty. We know that every minute 3 children die of hunger. You know, and so when faced with this, most people just get really afraid. You know, it's just getting worse. So they seem to think they're not acting. They're just being neutral. But as my friend says,
right,
when you're being
can't be neutral, right?
Exactly. You're just on the side of power. So
right.
if you could maybe talk a little bit about some of the suggestions to make of how we make entry into these issues and mm-hmm. how our actions impact the alternatives that can be brought forward.
Well, first of all, we need buddies because we are so socially embedded, right? I mean, this is our great strength and it's our Achilles heel. In other words, because we're so connected to one another, we evolve that way to need the approval of others. It's really hard to break away from the dominant direction, which is taking us right over Victoria Falls, is like the way I like to think of it. You know, we're back there on the savannah, but we're headed in the wrong direction. So buddies are essential. That we find people who are equally desirous of waking up and finding their power and stopping the depression, because, you know, depression is the global pandemic. Today in the world, there are 50% more suicides than homicides because we evolved to be powerful. So I think finding buddies is critical. And in fact, in my institute, Small Planet Institute, we're hoping to help people find groups who would like to go into the approach we take in getting a grip together. So if anybody's interested in that, they can email us at info@smallplanet.org and get together with others and find people in your community that are really want to break free of the powerlessness spiral. And recognizing the buddies are so important, I want to tell you that one of my favorite new studies I ran across at University of Virginia, where they took 2 groups of students and set them at the foot of a hill with a heavy backpack on all of their backs. And the only difference in the 2 groups was that one had a friend by their side, each person, and the others didn't. And then the experimenter said, okay, how steep is that hill in front of you? And the people who had the buddy by their side judged that hill to be significantly less steep, less daunting. And the longer they'd known that person, the more effect it had. And so, you know, I think the first step is not to feel too much alone in this, even though the dominant media can make us feel so alone. And that's why programs like yours, and I say to everybody I know, you know, make a commitment to yourself to at least once a week read a story, watch a story about possibility, about regular people who are seizing the power and developing the power themselves. And that's what keeps me going. I mean, I'm just amazed at what people don't know that's going on that's so positive. My latest thrill is telling people that the UN Environmental Program, for example, set the goal of 1 billion trees worldwide planted each year starting in 2007. And they, you know what? They have to keep upping their goal because they're now at 10 billion trees, more than. And it's only 3 years into this. And I thought, you know, you have little faith here, you know, I thought that, 1 billion is too ambitious. So my point is that to believe in possibility, we have to, since we are social creatures, we take in, you know, what we observe, that to actively bring in stories from programs like yours, Yes Magazine, for example, which you can find and subscribe to, make that commitment to bring in that diet, not just the healthy food diet, but the healthy media diet.
I guess sometimes fear tends to stop people from seeing alternatives. You know, how do we then make those connections? Because in your website, Small Planet Institute, you know, the only choice we have is whether or not we want to change the world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, if we really do think like an ecosystem, and you think that in nature, in wider nature, of course, we are nature, you know, everything is created by the context in which it is in and shaped, you know, a plant thrives or not depending on what situation it's in, what is the soil like, does it have access to the sunlight, etc. And so everything is shaped by everything around it. And that's what I mean when by saying the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world. Because every expression on our face affects the people around us. We walk into a supermarket, and if we purchase food that has been grown by spraying pesticides, we're sending back signals, and we're saying, yes, yes, more poisoning of pesticides. And already, you know, farm workers, at least in the U.S., their life expectancy is you know, around 50 years. So it's drastically less than the rest of the population, and part of that is exposure to pesticides. And, you know, we each have pesticides in our system with untold harm to us. So the point is that every choice we make is sending out signals, both directly by people observing us. I mean, we can think of so many examples of inspiration that we get from others saying, oh, I didn't know that was possible. Like, I was just at a wonderful gathering where I met a fellow who was not a mechanic, who was probably no more than 20 years old, who just built his own electric car for $1,300, including the price of a car. And so I said, well, how did you do that? He said, I went to the library, and he got a book. So just meeting him, I started telling other people, and who knows, you know, what other... my partner is very handy, and his eyes lit up. Oh, maybe I could do that. You know, in other words, I mean, this is such a, in one way, tiny, trivial example of how we affect others. But every act, whether it's a purchase, whether it's, you know, as I say, the way we treat one another, do we accelerate fear when we're out and about in our daily lives? Do we engage and look in people's eyes? And if we don't, then we are accelerating the fear cycle that keeps people from action just in subtle ways. So we have enormous power. And, of course, over, you know, our children who model themselves on us, what we tolerate from others in the workplace in terms of do we stand up for ourselves and our own dignity. So there's no end to the possibility. I think the question is finding that curiosity in ourselves that, once a famous historian, Theodore Zeldin, wrote that curiosity is the greatest antidote to fear. So if we live our lives driven by what we're curious about, then we can keep walking with that fear of the unknown and of rejection and live the life we want to live, which I think most of us want to live a really meaningful life where we get to the end and we say, wow, you know, I just kept going and I kept learning and I did my very best, right?
And that's so beautiful. You're so right. And, you know, one of the best ways to overcome fear, as you point out, is knowledge, information. So tell our audience, yes, how they can access your book, Get in a Grip 2, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage for the World We Really Want.
Oh, well, hopefully any bookstore would have it. You certainly can order it on Amazon. And as I said, if you're taken by the ideas in this book, and let me underscore that it's not a long book and it's organized into short chapters that I think groups can, and many have, you know, gotten into the discussion about it because it's really something I think that combines the psychological, the personal, shall we say, with the larger world. So if you please email us at info@smallplanet.org if you'd like us to help you find other people who would like to discuss the book with you. They're also downloadable on our website, smallplanet.org, the spirals that open and close the book so you can get a sense of the ideas in the book. And if you're interested in the arts of democracy I mentioned, such as creative conflict, for example, you can download from our website something called Doing Democracy, 10 Practical Arts, which is a 40-page booklet. So we are very easy to find and very eager to interact with people, because this book, Getting a Grip, is something I'm going to keep reprinting throughout the rest of my life and updating. So I need people to engage with me, what worked about it, what was moving, and what stories can I add from their own experience.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. As I mentioned in my introduction, Frances Moore-Lappe is well known worldwide. She's been called the Hope Warrior, and I think a very well-deserved name. And the book is just fantastic. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, you're so kind, and I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. Such important work. So thank you. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.